On today's episode of the Direct Podcast, we talk about the new Superman logo, Sydney Sweeney on Saturday Night Live, and we review what many are calling the movie of the year, Dune, Part 2, and everything else you need to know about the universes you love right here on the Direct Podcast.
Truth is,
I am a Jedi.
I'm the Vengeance.
And I am Iron Man.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in, welcome on, welcome back to another episode of the Direct Podcast, everything you need to know about the universes you love. I'm your host, Matt Rimke, and I am joined, as always, by my friend, co-host, box office correspondent, senior editor at thedirect.com, and the biggest David Corinsweat fan in the game, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. David Thompson. David, what's up, buddy?
What's up, man? I'm doing pretty good. There's no way, by the way, I'm the biggest David Corinsweat fan in the game. I haven't even seen several projects that he's been in. The only reason I even mentioned him that one time was because I saw Hollywood. And that and sure. People do pull those Hollywood clips, like saying how he can make a pretty good Clark Kent, which obviously I agree. But yeah, it's been a good weekend. Happy to be with you here on Monday. The NFL Combine was this weekend in Indy. It wasn't that exciting this year. Someone did break the 40-yard dash record, which was really, really cool.
Xavier Woods.
And I can't wait for the NFL draft. That's coming up at the end of April, I believe. It's still a ways to go. Next Monday is going to be wild. You're definitely going to be hearing a bit of sports chat on that episode of the Rec Podcast because a lot of the free agency moves are going to happen next Monday during the tampering period, quote unquote. So apparently that'll be pretty exciting. I'm hoping the Colts maybe make a move for Ladarius Sneed or something like that. It's not going to happen, but I hope we re-sign our guys. I hope we get an extension with Pittman, bring Grover back, all those things. But yeah, man, I'm excited, enjoying the offseason of the NFL, getting more into the Heat, obviously, NBA going on. Caitlin Clark is an absolute sensation. And by the way, congratulations.
Thank you. Coming to Indiana. Thank you. It's great for the Naptown. It's great for the Circle City. Caitlin Clark is going to bring a lot of money into the 317. We're very excited to have her at the Indiana Fever. Like, I'm moving back just in time to go to as many Fever games as I can. I'm going to watch the hell out of some Caitlin Clark. You best believe it.
It'll be over the summer. That's awesome.
I'm so excited. That's so cool. Like, and I have friends who, like, I texted a bunch of people. And I have friends who are like, oh, we've known this for a long time. I'm like, yeah, but it's official now. Like, she's a vindictive bitch. Like, she will stay in Iowa until she wins the championship, if that is her prerogative. But no, she's deciding to come play for the Fever. We're very pumped. For those who don't know, like, the Combine in Indianapolis, the thing about Indianapolis is everything's right there. Like, the entire everything you can think of, the convention center, Lucas Oil Stadium, every hotel, every restaurant, all of it is right there within walking distance more often than not. Yeah. And that's where a lot of the moving and shaking happens for NFL free agency. The coaches are there. The GMs are there. The agents are all there. And a lot of the, especially now that NIL is here, a lot of the agents of these college athletes are also agents of a bunch of pro athletes. So conversations are happening. We got Todd Haley getting drunk at Elmo's Steakhouse, you know, just hanging out. I'll never forget when I heard, I was downtown during the Combine one night, and I heard Todd Haley just got arrested. I'm like, no, he did not. And then I looked at the story. I'm like, he got, like, stabbed at a bar, like, two doors down from where I was one day.
Wow.
And I'm like, I love Todd Haley. What's happening right now? Like, very funny. Very funny. Did you see Jim Harbaugh at the Combine?
Briefly,
it's probably coincidence, but his seat was right under his Ring of Honor banner.
Oh, is that right? That's so cool.
Which, like, and Rich Eisen said it during the broadcast, like, if you're going to sit anywhere, sit under where your name is, as a Ring of Honor member for your Indianapolis Colts.
That's pretty badass.
Cardiac Colts, baby. People forget. People forget what you shouldn't forget, listener. See that? That's pro as fuck. See that shit? What you shouldn't forget, listener, is that we are just about a month away from our X-Men rewatch. We're going to start recording those here soon, actually, in the next couple weeks, because we got some scheduling stuff, but just getting everybody in their headspace. You know what I mean? We're going to watch a lot of X-Men over these next few months, and we're going to talk about them in a very big way. I'm very pumped about it. You know, just so you guys know, like, we do this for a lot of stuff. We watched all the Spider-Men leading up to No Way Home, because of the event that was ahead of the Batman. We rewatched all the Nolan Batman movies, which was really fun. I assume before Superman comes out, we're going to rewatch Man of Steel.
We'll rewatch all of them. That'd be a blast. Or at least
all of what? All of what?
Superman movies. We'll at least do. Oh no, not the DCEU. No, no, sir.
I thought you were going to put the DCEU on me. I'm like, no.
No, we will at least watch, let's say, 78 Returns and Man of Steel, or we do Superman 1 and 2 Returns and Man of Steel, maybe something like that.
Yeah, I'll look into it. I don't remember 3 very much, but I think it was a little more of just a let's get Richard the Pryor into
one.
I think it's the Richard Pryor one.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken, which I love Richard Pryor, don't get me wrong, but like, you know, if we're putting Richard Pryor in the Superman movie, it's probably not the, you know, trilogy ending movie that we expect a third superhero movie to be nowadays, right? But we'll at least watch one Returns of Man of Steel, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Because that's the generations, right? That is eras of Superman. Those are reboots.
Gene Hackman, Lex Luthor. Kevin Spacey, Lex Luthor. And then
Michael Shannon, Zod.
Michael Shannon doing the damn thing. Oh, it's going to be great. I'm so excited.
Maybe by then we'll know who the main villain is of, like, or not of Legacy, of Superman.
And we will get into that very shortly. So everybody get ready for the X-Men rewatch. Another thing. Listen up, everybody. The Direct has gone visual. We are officially on YouTube. We have a YouTube channel at thedirect.com. It's called The Direct Extras, E-X-T-R-A-S. The Direct Extras is on YouTube. It is full of videos right now for you to watch of our boy, our guy, our, you know, one of the harder workers we have here at The Direct. I know it's not me. I know for a fact it ain't me, but it might just be Russ Milheim. Our boy Russ Milheim is interviewing everybody. And David Thompson also interviewing people for The Direct. And we're covering so many projects. Avatar The Last Airbender. We are covering every TV show you can imagine come out. We have like 5 different Monarch interviews, including an interview with our guy, Matt Shackman, over on The Direct Extras YouTube page. He has an interview with Wahlberg.
Yeah, there was an interview for Shogun that Russ did recently. Shogun, that's a very popular show I haven't gotten into yet. Yeah. Yeah.
2 or 3 of them. Percy Jackson interviews, all that. All of our interviews are over on the Direct Extras YouTube page. Make sure to check that out, because you might start seeing mine and David's beautiful faces on there as well. We're going to start adding some Direct podcast clips onto the Direct Extras page. But for right now, all of our exclusive interviews over there. Make sure to check that out. Hit the bell. Is that what the kids say? Ring the bell. Smash that subscribe button. You know what I mean? Hi, guys. I'm Corey. I could be a YouTuber, right?
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
I could probably pull it off. Make sure to go check that out. The Direct Extras YouTube page. It'll help us a lot. And every view that the Direct podcast gets over there counts toward this. So the more we watch, the more we grow. It'll be a good time.
Just one thing on that. I will be putting that link in the bio. So either above or below the time codes, you'll see by now, if you were looking at your phone or wherever you're listening to this right now, it will be there, easily accessed. My interview on there, just a quick shameless plug for where you can find my face already on there. I interviewed the showrunner for the second best hospital in the galaxy, which is a new Amazon Prime. It's kind of like a Comedy Central animated, obviously a comedy. It's pretty good. I've watched the show. It's pretty funny, and you can check out that interview there as well.
You want to go to the second best hospital in the galaxy, because the first one has to be just so expensive.
That's
like
a great
hospitals
point.
Are expensive no matter what. The best hospital of the it's got to be gouging you out the wazoo. Let me try it. Okay, full YouTuber voice. Hey guys, I'm Matt. Make sure to smash the subscribe button. Check out the link in the bio. Go check out the Direct Extras.
That's awesome. That should be on the channel. Yeah, we should just
I can get the broccoli hair. You know what I mean? Every single one of them.
I love it.
A lot of Oblivious, I'm sure. That's that. That's our plugs. Get ready for X-Men. Get ready. Go check out the Direct Extras YouTube page. And right now, everything you need to know about the universes you love.
That's slander.
It is not. I resent that. Slander is spoken. In print, it's libel.
All right, everybody, here it is. Everything you need to know about the universes you love. And we begin today with probably some of the biggest news we've had in a while. The hype train for James Gunn's Superman. And along with that, James Gunn's DCU has been rolling for quite some time. But today, last week, whenever this dropped, it's official. It has begun. We got our very first look at the new Superman suit for David Corenswet and James Gunn's Superman. This is when a movie starts, you know, really building that suspense. You know, this is what we've been waiting for, David. The suit for Superman is such a big deal. And we got our first look at it. And with that, our first look at the new Superman logo. Let's start there. David Thompson, this is your guy. You are the David Corenswet prophet. This is your Superman that you've been very excited about for a very long time. You're the Superman fan here. You're the Henry Cavill stan. I'm the James Gunn guy.
Yeah.
We got a lot going on here. Your overall thoughts and initial reactions to the new Superman suit.
Quickly, I think it looks awesome. Obviously, it was rumored, it basically got leaked that it was going to be a Kingdom Come-esque symbol because of the table reading that they did and an Instagram post. Regardless, I think the interpretation of the suit and the symbol look fantastic so far. It's sleek. I think that the coloring is awesome. I love the gold trim specifically, where it's not just the basic red and gold and then the blue surrounding, but there's actually gold outlining the outside, which to me kind of actually makes the S look a little more prominent, even though it is that kind of alternate symbol of being like from Kingdom Come, where it doesn't look like a proper S, right? So with all that being said, overall thoughts, I think it looks great. One quick note that I haven't mentioned yet to anyone, but I really wanted to nail on the podcast, is that it is inspired by Alex Ross. And I haven't seen enough people talking about how big the symbol is. How the symbol itself, just based on the initial look, I'm looking at it right now, it is massive. Like, it's a very, you know, it's a zoomed in close up look. You get a lot of details here that we want to dive into a little bit more once you share your overall thoughts. But it is big, man. Like, this thing is going to be the biggest live action Superman symbol I think we've ever gotten. And I really haven't heard your thoughts yet. Obviously, Superman's birthday, leap day, big deal. This released, you saw it. What were your initial thoughts and what are you thinking now about it?
My initial thoughts are that Superman's birthday, leap day, also the birthday of this dog right here, Indy Boy. He turned 4 years old, which means he turned 1 year old on that day as well. That was pretty fun.
That's awesome.
I love this logo. I agree that it's huge. I think that it being so big is going to be jarring at first, but once we see it move, it's going to be really cool to have such a big, prominent Superman logo right there on the front. Yeah. I love it. It's just a little glimpse. They really hit it because it's so big. They really hit the blue. But yeah, I love the blue, man. That's what I was most worried. It's not the right word. I was most excited to see how they were going to handle the blue in the Superman suit, because there really isn't a default Superman blue. There's that royal blue that you're wearing right now on your shirt. The like OG Superman blue is very light, almost like that new Fantastic Four blue that we're seeing.
Yeah.
Obviously, the Henry Cavill one is so unbelievably navy that it's like, you know, when we first saw it, it was so new and different. But after so long, like, that's kind of what a lot of general audiences think the Superman blue is, that navy blue.
Yeah.
So to see this kind of like crisp, more royal like your shirt blue pop it in right here on the corner of the new logo. Super excited about that, because that's going to really make it stand out. And the S itself, coming from the Kingdom Come design, I love how it is built into the badge. I love how it's not an S within the classic Superman diamond that we see, which is like, that's the original one. It's the diamond with an S written in it. And
right,
the Henry Cavill one is a very super, almost graffiti like S within the badge still. This is built within the badge, and I think it's just such a unique way to take on arguably the most iconic comic book symbol of all time. Like, it's either this or Batman. There really isn't. I guess Captain America probably now. Now that Cap has, because you know, you see those Captain America shield shirts.
Yeah.
Everywhere, right?
Yeah. Well, it becomes more of just, it's almost less comic booky and more just like a USA style thing.
Which is, you know, that's so sick. But like, man, I kind of want a Cap shirt now. but like the Superman shirts, like when I was in high school, like Superman shirts were like kind of my thing, you know, as nerdy or like douchey as that might be. Yeah. But like I had so many different Superman shirts of all different kinds. I had the OG, I had the Henry Cavill, I had the black and white, I had this, right. All of it. But what's so cool about this to me is that it took what I loved about the Henry Cavill suit, that being the texture, the more tactile, layered kind of vibe that it has, you know, that thread to it,
yeah,
that the Henry Cavill suit has, but it added a pop of color, which is what I always wanted Henry Cavill's suit to have, like it had at the end of Black Adam a little more color,
yeah,
there at the end of Black Adam. Huge fan. I love it. Very excited about it.
Yeah, it's interesting you brought up the texture because I really wanted to discuss this with you because we got this close up, right? And because it's so close, we see all of these details. And something that I love is that there's real texture to it. It almost looks like one of those kickballs that you would play with in like the schoolyard when you were a kid, with that kind of like thread look, but it looks almost like rubber to me.
Sure.
And like the indentations around the S, it's less of an S and more of just like a symbol, but there's real like grooves within it where we haven't talked about the snow yet, but where the snow is literally wedged in between some of like the lettering and, you know, obviously kind of the canal between the gold and the red there. Like there's real texture and depth to it. And that, like you mentioned, is very similar to Henry Cavill in the sense where very textured. Obviously that had like the Kryptonian writing on it because in Man of Steel, it's a very big point that the suit is Kryptonian.
Stands for hope.
Stands for hope.
Mm-hmm.
Sure does. And one thing I do really like about this is that it's kind of leaning against or going against it being an S, and it is more of just like a symbol. Mm-hmm. Whereas there is something kind of silly about it being an S. Like you mentioned, it is an iconic logo and symbol, right? The Superman S, but Captain America, Batman, right? It's their symbols, their logos. It's like a representation. It's not literally like a C and a B, right? Stuff like that. Yeah. So I do really appreciate that. You mentioned the blue. The coloring is, I think, going to be a lot more clear when it's more of a, I guess, maybe not naturally lit, but this seems to be in a very dim area. And I think some people on the internet were thinking it was going to look, or it was going to look even brighter than it is. But I think that's not a proper representation. And yeah, that blue specifically, I'm very excited to see in like a full suit reveal.
Yeah, it's going to be great. And the reason that I think the blue is so important is because the big red cape is going to be a big red cape. Like they're not going to go away from that. So right. Like the blue needs to stand out on the cape. And I'm really pumped about it. And yeah, man, I think this is a great. It's so weird to get so excited about such a small thing. You know what I mean? Like this is just a very still shot of a super zoomed in Superman suit. But like this is the first step into what this next DC era is going to be. Not just Superman, everything about yeah. I will stand on the hill that the greatest thing the DCU did was their costumes, and like everything they did as far as suits and costumes outside of the Batman Superman fighting suit. I think they're like batting 1,000. When it yeah. comes to costumes, and being able to like move forward from that is going to be challenging, but I'm really excited about what this is. You mentioned the snow. It's covered in snow. Any Superman fan knows that has a Fortress of Solitude leaning note to it,
yeah.
I guess you could say. So I guess my question for you is, the Superman fan, what do you think the Fortress of Solitude is going to play into what a year one Superman story kind of looks like? We've been told it's not going to be like a true origin, which, you know, Man of Steel technically wasn't like a, you know, like we didn't know a young Clark growing up, you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's an origin like, story though, for sure. Man of Steel,
definitely, but it's not like in Iron Man where we meet Tony first and then he becomes Iron Man, like,
right.
Like it's interesting. So how do you think they're going to like introduce the Fortress of Solitude while also reintroducing Superman to new fans?
Yeah, I mean, when we get to the fortress, which apparently they're filming in Norway right now, that's like apparently where they are.
Norway's
pretty
beautiful,
pretty cool. literally. With that being said, that's a great question. There's a lot of speculation, and not leaks, but just rumors and ideas, and what could this mean? The facts are, they said that this story, it was either Safran or Gunn, Peter Safran and James Gunn talked about how the movie is going to be focused on him dealing with his basically Earth life, you know, his life in Metropolis at the planet, and then also dealing with his Kryptonian past. It was something along those lines. So I imagine that with the Fortress, this is going to be how we get into some of those, the Kryptonian past, right? His Kryptonian heritage, I believe, is what they said. And that is going to be the way in. And I think I'm curious with this new Superman movie, how long he has been Superman, because that has not been confirmed. James Gunn has not given us like, and I don't think he ever will, he hasn't given us like a specific time. Whereas with the Batman and Matt Reeves and Robert Pattinson, we knew it was 1 year in. He was 1 year in, and we were kind of going into year two. This, we're not quite sure. So with the Fortress of Solitude, this could already be a regular thing. And I think that's going to be a lot of this movie, kind of like Spider-Man Homecoming, a little bit like the Batman, where we are jumping into this character from the jump, and we already see him doing Superman-ass things, right? Being Clark Kent, being at the, you know, at the planet, you know, going to the Fortress of Solitude. Lex Luthor's involved, Lois, like all these characters are already in the universe and already set. So this is going to be a part of obviously not only a Superman activity, but a Kal-El activity as well. And it'll be very interesting to see, I mean, it's the first thing they're filming, how much is at the Fortress and how many scenes, and does he go back? Is it just one scene? Is it multiple scenes? Is it one of those things where he's not just there once in the movie, but he's discovering more and more as he ventures back and forth? It's exciting stuff. It's crazy. You mentioned how big of a deal it was. I tweeted something out where February 29th, 2024 was the second biggest day in the new DCU history, only behind, what was it, January 31st, 2023, when all the announcements came out. And that's where we are, you know, and it's so, and it is so silly and so crazy because we have a snow dusted, zoomed in, you know, crest, but it is. And there's just so much speculation, and I'm just so excited.
Look at you with the tee up transition. On that slate announcement that we got, we learned that the title of this movie would be Superman Legacy. Well, drop the legacy. It's cleaner. It is now Superman. We have transitioned into it now being Superman exclamation mark. Explanation mark? Exploration mark?
Close.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Superman. David, obviously, we've been calling it Superman Legacy for over a year now. I know this was tough for you to lose the legacy titling just because we were so excited about it. But what are your thoughts on the title change? Do you think it really means all that much? Or do you think this is more of a branding thing? You know, let's just Superman. It's cleaner.
Yeah, I think it is cleaner. I think that's part of it. I saw people online were mentioning how the original Christopher Reeve Superman was marketed as Superman the movie. So technically, marketing-wise, this will be the first just Superman movie. And I do think beyond it just being simpler and cleaner, this really, I think for many people, will show a reboot, you know, where it's just Superman. There is no legacy. There was, even if legacy, and I think we should keep legacy in mind for themes. Sequel. It may be a sequel, but just for this movie, like it was called Legacy for a reason. Then James Gunn said, oh, I finished and reworked the script and, you know, just wrapped up the script. It's just Superman, you know, but why was it initially Legacy? What are those threads and possible storylines that you'll be able to kind of see Legacy in? So I think it'll still be present, but for marketing, I love Superman. It is so clean. It is so perfect. And it is crazy to say, I'm in on the name. It's crazy to say that this movie has already so much pressure and anticipation on it and just unbelievable stakes, and making it just Superman rose those just a little bit more, you know. It really did, because I know Christopher Reeves, it was quote unquote the movie. That's Superman. When you say the movie Superman, that is what you think.
78.
In 20 years, are we still going to think that? or are we going to think this? And that is a moment in time. Like, because genuinely, if this movie sucks, which it could, I don't think it's going to at all. If it sucks, man, like, what a terrible bummer. And you would still think of that Superman when you say that title. But I have faith in James Gunn and the creative crew, so I'm all in.
Yeah, I mean, new members of the Direct Podcast, just remember our circle of trust: Feige, Favreau, Filoni, James Gunn, and I think Tony Gilroy made his way in there. These are just people who we trust, and we're very excited. And yeah, man, I think just Superman with a big exclamation point at the end, I think it's going to be a really exciting title. I can't wait for the logo treatment. That's what I'm most excited about.
Yeah,
is to see the first logo for this movie, along with this Superman S, which, like you said, it's not really an S, which I think is so fucking cool. Yeah, man, I think that this is a great start to what I'm hoping is a great DCU. You know, a rising tide raises all boats. So, like, you know, we need great comic book movies, especially when we have really bad comic book movies being turned out, like Madame Web. And, you know, this is a good start. So we're very excited. And that's not the only thing that has changed about Superman. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a Perry White breaking news. Water. Wet. To this day, the best line in the DC.
I know.
Water. Wet. Wendell Pierce. People are really excited about this. I don't know shit about Wendell Pierce, if I'm being completely honest.
Yeah.
I saw Selma. I can't remember him in it, like specifically. There was so much, you know, in that movie, obviously a very, you know, big, dense movie, but and I was never really a Wire guy. I've seen the first season, but I don't remember him specifically from the Wire. Do you have any Wendell Pierce experience? Or
he looks familiar. I have not seen the Wire.
He does look familiar. Seen,
right. And not as Perry White, but I think he will make a great Perry White, just, you know, based on what I've seen of him, which were a few clips on Twitter. You know, obviously immediately someone's cast, there's somebody on Twitter posting clips being like, hey, here's how, you know, here's why he's going to be great, quote unquote.
He's been my dream Perry White ever since they announced Superman back in 2008. No, he has not.
And I thought it was so funny when people were posting when Nicholas Holt was cast as Lex, posting clips of the menu. And it's like, dude, that is not how Lex Luthor's going to be at all.
He was so good in that movie, though.
Oh, he's excellent.
He was so good in that movie.
I can't wait for Miss Lex.
Scared the hell out of me, man.
Yeah, he's going to be so good. But yeah, with Wendell Pierce, I haven't seen either of the shows he's known for, but looks good.
Yeah, it's good stuff. We're very excited. And Rachel Brosnahan, who's adorable, by the way. I'm developing a very large crush on Rachel Brosnahan.
Same.
The TikTok video of the cast all together. Great. It's great to see everybody having fun, because there's some times in Hollywood where actors don't have fun making. And I don't know why. I don't know why we did it. But on Saturday night, me and the wife, we had a couple glasses of wine. We watched SNL.
Yeah.
We watched Sydney Sweeney's SNL. A lot of big boob jokes, but she's got big boobs, so that works. I stand by pizza, babies, boobs, the three most universally beloved things in the world. Nobody doesn't love those things. Like, pizza, and it's babies. Hard to find a negative to any of it, right?
That's awesome.
The biggest thing coming out of Sydney Sweeney's SNL, though, you've seen me on Euphoria or Anything But You, big applause. You definitely didn't see me on Madame Web. I mean, I don't know who makes that decision. I don't know how far away from a movie you need to be for that to be a thing. That movie came out like 2 weeks ago, dude.
Yeah.
What do we think of her on the biggest live television show of all time, ripping Madame Web?
Yeah, we watched it too. We watch SNL a lot, actually. But with that being said, I loved it. Immediately, I'm like, awesome. But a box office joke, you know? No one saw it.
Right?
You look at the numbers. She's not. Because that's what I said to Jasmine. I'm like, she is throwing shade at Madame Web. Like, it sucks. But also, she's just saying, like, no one's going to see the movie. It's a straight up fact. Like, and Anyone But You setting records. Euphoria is a phenomenon. So it all just made sense to me. There was an objective point to it where, like, you said, like, who makes these decisions? And like the joke itself, it's like kind of wrote itself. Like, no one saw Madame Web. It completely crashed. Not only its opening weekend, it made $6 million its second weekend. I mean, it was unbelievably bad. So
crushing in China.
Is it?
Uh-huh. It's going to get over 100.
Well, that'll fuel the rest of the SSU. On this, though, is Sydney Sweeney's SNL. Really quick, besides the Madam Web part, I did not like this episode. I thought most of the skits were bad. There was, who was just recently on there? Well, they had Shane Gillis on there last week, which was funny. But they've had some other ones recently that have been on there that were just funnier to me. Like, I felt like it was a poorly written episode, and they almost did too much of the whole, like, boob thing, you know?
Where, a lot
like,
of boob jokes.
Trying to get her in these situations and stuff. I did love how Glenn Powell was there. That was awesome. That opening monologue. He was
there just for the monologue.
Does nothing. Yeah.
This is her show. Let her do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That was cool.
The monologue I thought was really good. I thought the monologue was great. It was set up. She had a great joke. You probably know me from like screaming, crying, and having sex.
Yeah.
Sometimes all at the same time. I'm like, yeah. That is what people know you for.
That was really funny.
That and then the internet sleuth spit found him. That was so funny.
Yeah.
I thought that was great. And Weekend Update's never not good. But
I love Weekend Update.
It's the reason you watch SNL. But everything else, like the Hooters bit was funny, but it was like the eighth boob joke of the episode.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, like, yeah, it's Sydney Sweeney. They're going to have boob jokes. Yeah. Sure. But like that being at the end, I think that should have been an earlier sketch. If you're going to do that many boob jokes throughout the episode, put that earlier because that was their best one, I thought.
Right. Yep. I'm with you. It just wasn't the best SNL. Like it got a lot of views, obviously, because Sydney Sweeney, but it's like, damn, like they didn't even, I feel like they didn't have the best skits in that one. Like some just weren't that great for me. But that's all right. The opening monologue, Madam Web, all those jokes, Glenn Powell, that really, just watch that. If you haven't seen it, just watch the opening monologue on YouTube and call it a day.
Maybe watch the waving goodbye at the
end. Maybe watch that. You've already seen that, though. Maybe watch the Hooters skit. The Hooters skit is actually pretty funny.
There's
like a random cut in the Hooters skit that we rewound like three times. We're like, did it actually just cut right now? So funny.
That was a nip slip, for sure. Ladies and gentlemen, that's everything you need to know about the universes you love. Let's do it, David. Let's get into it. Let's head back to Arrakis. Dune 2. And your starting lineup for Dune Part 2. Timothée Chalamet returns as Paul Atreides / the Mahdi / Lisa Azal Ghul / all those names on that Danny Targaryen shit. You know what I'm saying? Zendaya as Shani, Rebecca Ferguson as Reverend Mother Jessica, Javier Bardem as Stilgar, Josh Brolin as Gurney Halleck, Dave Bautista as Beast Raven, Stellan Skarsgård as Baron Harkonnen, Charlotte Rampling as Reverend Mother Mohim, and your new players for Dune Part 2, Austin Butler as Fade Rafa, Florence Pugh as Princess Arulan?
Anybody? Sure. I don't know.
We're not good at this.
I'm terrible at pronunciations.
Christopher Walken as the Emperor, Leia Seydoux as Lady Margot Finnring, and Anya Taylor-Joy as Leia Atreides. Wow. Directed by Denis Villeneuve, written by Denis and John Spates, composed by Hans Zimmer. Hans Zimmer gets the Kate Herron, right? No. Yeah. Who's a low-key composer that I love?
Natalie Holt, right?
Natalie fucking Holt. Yeah. Hans Zimmer gets the fucking
same way. We did this on the low-key review.
Yeah, well, I get her mixed up. Natalie fucking Holt and Hans fucking Zimmer. They get the F in the middle of their name. You know what I mean? I feel like John Williams does it because it's John Williams.
I think Ludwig
fucking Hans Göransson.
Göransson, yeah. He's gonna win an Oscar next week.
Hell yeah, he's gonna win an Oscar when he makes the Mando movie. Ladies and gentlemen, that's your starting lineup for Dune Part 2. We're very excited to talk about it. I'm here, David's here. We're being joined by a person who I've been texting for 7 straight days about this movie, and I've said a lot of mean things to this person because he's threatened to spoil it, and he's not even threatening, he's just saying words, and I'm like, no, shut your fucking mouth. Ladies and gentlemen, you know him, you love him, he's our sci-fi correspondent this week, our Star Wars correspondent, Jack Pugh. Pew-pew-pews, Jack, how we doing, how are you, what are your overall thoughts about Dune 2?
You know, I usually talk Star Wars on this podcast, and it doesn't feel that much different coming on for right? Very, very, very similar. heading right into overall thoughts, a perfect movie. A perfect movie. That is, that is my stance. People have brought up Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, 2001, A Space Odyssey, crowning achievements of the sci-fi genre. And I want to throw out Lawrence of Arabia, Ben-Hur, Spartacus, some of the greatest movie epics of all time. And that's exactly what Dune Part 2 is, especially in conjunction with Dune Part 1. Sheer spectacle, led by a visionary. And you just, you truly enter Arrakis in the world of Dune when the movie starts. You never leave. You're never anywhere else. I've seen it three times now, and I can say every single time, I've never left the world of Dune. I'm still there mentally. Usually when it comes to movies, it's story, it's thematic elements, philosophical concepts. Like, those are the things that usually like keep me coming back to certain films. And that's definitely the case with this movie. But other than Avatar 2, I've never been so stunned by a movie's visuals before. And even with that one, there's always the uncanny valley, because it, a lot more of it is fake, if you will, or visual effects. Yeah. This felt real. It felt tangible. It has that like Spielberg-esque, I can reach out and touch it feeling. And look, there's so much to love about the movie. We'll talk about it all. But the one thing that really stuck out to me on the third watch, every single element of this movie excels. And more than that, they help each other succeed. The rhythm of the editing bolsters action sequences, which highlights the visual effects. The scale and the lighting highlights the relationships, which the score highlights the relationships and that scale. They all work to make the other better. And in my book, that's a masterpiece. I didn't just see this movie. I felt it. I experienced it. And that's the ultimate victory when going to the movie theater, guys. So
we're recording this on March 4th. This movie came out 6 days ago. Jack has seen it three times. It's aggressive.
Twice
here. They called me a madman.
They called me a madman. Jack, that was great. David Thompson, overall thoughts?
Yeah, my overall thoughts were, first off, just before we get to the movie, what an awesome theater experience. We walk into this theater, same theater me and Jasmine went and saw Barbie at back in July. And the first thing she says to me, this is a 7:45 screening on a Saturday night. She's like, this is the busiest it's been since Barbenheimer. And I'm like, yes, like, let's go there. This movie, I think Jack hit some amazing points about like where this kind of stands and just like the effect it's had. And we're going to dive into more of those details. I want to focus on what this film means for movie going, because we need movies like this where the word of mouth is so positive, people feel the need to go out to the movie theater, which we are losing every single year. COVID had a big impact on this, but every single year, more and more people, and this is any genre, any movie, I'll wait on streaming. I'll wait for digital. I'll wait until I can watch it at home. Dune Part 2 is a movie you must see in a theater. I'm going again this week to see it in Dolby, and I cannot wait. It is, I do think that, just to zag a little bit, I don't think Dune Part 2 is as good as some of those upper echelon best direct sequels of all time. That's just my opinion. It'll take time, I think, is kind of the bottom line. But with all of that being said, I love this world, and I liked it in the first movie. I loved it in this movie. Like, getting into the actual lore of Dune and the characters and the people and Arrakis, it is an experience. And very rarely do we go out to a theater, someone like us that go to see movies more than the general person, and it is a true experience that you go through in a movie theater. It's not just, I'm sitting, I'm watching Madam Web, I'm watching Anyone But You, I'm watching this, and it's just like, I'm having fun, you know, it's a pretty good movie. Or Madam Web's like just terrible, and then you're having a horrible experience. Or Wonka, oh, it's delightful. That was fun. I enjoyed that movie. I didn't enjoy Dune Part 2, the movie. I enjoyed Dune Part 2, the experience, the feeling through my body that happened while watching it. And yeah, it's a special movie, and I'm so happy that everyone else is enjoying it. So more and more people we'll head out to the movie theater and check it out.
Going off that movie experience, I've been very blessed to do this podcast. Not blessed. I've been very thankful to do this podcast for the past 4 years. I've reviewed a ton of movies on here. David, you and I have reviewed a ton of movies. Jack, we've reviewed probably close to 50 episodes of television together here on this podcast. And back to back to back to back years, I've been able to do these movie theater experiences, reacting to them on this podcast. Spider-Man No Way Home in 2021, Top Gun Maverick in 2022, watched it the other night, still great. Oppenheimer last year, and now Dune 2. I've talked about movies and I've talked about TV on this podcast with my friends for a very long time. It is genuinely one of my favorite things to do, is talk about movies and TV, especially in this ilk, this environment where we're talking about why we loved or didn't love something. And I'm very confident that there is no sequence of words. There is no, you know, package of thoughts and ideas. There is no poet walking through that door that can define Dune Part 2 better than these five words. This movie is fucking awesome. It's just awesome. The acting is upper echelon. The production will suck you in. The sound alone, you can close your eyes and still feel this movie. Everything you see, watch, and experience is truly, like, this is what movies are. This is why people love movies. This is the kind of movie that will get somebody more interested into the sounds of other movies, the visuals of other movies, the acting and what it could, you know, present in other movies. But as fancy as you want to get, as many details as you want to point out, awesome. This movie is awesome. And it's just, there's something about it, the way everything combines together to make the impact that it made on every single person watching it. You won't see a lot of negative reviews about this one, because at the end of the day, it's awesome. And I'm really excited for Dune Part 2 just to be here, for us to talk about it. I can't wait for the next one. I can't wait to see it again. And I can't wait to see what this does, not just, like you said, David, for the sci-fi genre, but for the movie-going experience. Because me and Aaron, we rewatched Top Gun Maverick the other night, kind of on a whim, kind of riding the high of Dune 2 a little bit, you know, for being honest. And she pointed out, like, Top Gun Maverick is a movie that she saw, and it made her think about the sounds in movies, because it won Best Picture for sound editing, if I'm not mistaken. So. The Oscar for sound editing, I mean. Mm-hmm. And that movie in a theater was, like, such an experience, and, you know, that movie's way more fun than this movie, I can tell you. But she remembers that's a movie that made her think about the sounds in movies, and then Oppenheimer happened, and obviously, like, the sounds in that movie alone are, like, chilling to your bone. And she came into Dune 2, and her first thing when she walked out was like, man, that sounded great. And, like, Aaron's a very casual moviegoer, and the progress of Maverick to Oppenheimer to this is what made her invest in it, to now she loves the sound in a good movie. And Dune is that kind of movie that will get people interested into different levels of this shit. But at the end of the day, we're going to talk for probably another hour about this movie right now. Awesome is the best word to describe it, and I don't think we're going to come up with anything better. It's fucking awesome. Yeah. Dune Part 2, it's great, and I'm really excited. You know, best sci-fi movie ever, best direct sequel ever, all this stuff. I think if we're able to put Part 1 and 2 together the same way we often do with Infinity War and Endgame, we're talking Hall of Fame. We're talking, right, like, Mount Rushmore-type movies. By itself, we're still talking, you know, multi-time all-star, Hall of Fame nominee, that kind of thing. Like, it's really amazing. I can't wait to talk about it. I don't think it's perfect, but what it does well overshadows everything it does poorly by a million, by a fucking million. It's a Golden State Warriors team that, you know, maybe their defense, they're scoring 160 points a game. Who cares, right? Like, it's very exciting to watch. And I can't wait to bring in our good friend Michael Keaton as we talk about spoilers.
Now you want to get nuts? Come on, let's get nuts.
All right, here we go. Dune Part 2, directed by Denis Villeneuve. Jack Pugh, as our friend and guest, I want you to go first. Who is your biggest winner? Who, what, when, why? What is your biggest winner for Dune Part 2? And no, despite what David tried to do, you cannot just take the whole cast.
No.
What a wild move by you.
This was when the rules were different. It was not one wild. Yeah.
you really threw it out there, though. You swung for the fences.
Can I just take the whole cast? Yeah, sure. Yeah,
yeah, whatever. Matt and I will find something else to talk about.
We are about to cover, like, nearly 10 winners in this movie. If we were just covering three, I think one of them should have been the cast. The entire cast. Yeah.
It's fair. It's a good cast.
All right, Jack. What's your first winner? I'm so excited.
Well, with that cast, I kind of debated being different, being that guy. Oh, I'll come up with something unique. And
we can't whatever. All no, be different it. Here. We got to hit the big ones.
I know. It's Timothy feel like we fucking do that Chalamet, dude.
It's Timothy Chalamet. Like, yeah. I tried to find another one. I can't. It's him. Matt.
He's him.
When he is him. You guys did a primer for this last week. Or just, you know, talked about, you know, in prep for the movie. And I remember you mentioned, at this point, I'd already seen it. Podcast came out Monday. I saw it Sunday, early IMAX screening. Oh, I hadn't been IMAX in a little bit.
Yeah.
So good. So good. You said something along the lines of you had never gotten lost in a Timothée Chalamet performance. And I agreed with you. Like, before Dune 2, I was like, you know what? Yeah, like, every time I see him, it does always, it just has that thing of, I'm watching Timothée Chalamet act. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the same thing with Leonardo DiCaprio. Like, don't get me wrong, this is not a knock on either of them. But whenever I see Leo, I see Leo. I can't really see anything else.
Tom Hanks, too, for me.
Wahlberg. Yeah, Tom Hanks is another one.
Yeah, Wahlberg for sure. On a different echelon, though, I'd say.
just a little different.
I'm on Arrakis. What do you want me to do?
God, I kind of want to see that now. Uncharted 2. Yeah. Take us to Dune. this, when you said that, I was like, man, I completely agree if I hadn't just seen this movie on Sunday, because I got lost in his performance. He became something else entirely. And in we're going to talk about the second half of this movie, but even in the first half of the movie, there's an honesty and a sincerity to his performance that I haven't seen from him before. I've seen that vibe from him, but just never in this way. Like, the best way I can describe it is during the scene with Zendaya in the wind trap, because there's that very intimate close up of him just staring at her. She's like, "Stop looking at me like that." And I was getting lost in Timothy's eyes. Like, I don't know. There's something so like honest and true and genuine about that look and his falling in love with her. And then the guy just does a complete 180. And this is where he transforms. Like, everything that was present in his performance in the first half of the film is gone after drinking the water of life. His heart is drowned out in this prophecy. He ascends into something scary as fuck. And for me, the scene that solidified it was at that leaders' council in the South. And when he screamed, "I'm pointing the way," I was like, "Oh, fuck. What, like, what am I about to watch?" He transcends into another level of acting. And he loses himself. I got lost in him. He became the Lisan Al-Gaib of acting in that moment. The dichotomy between his two performances as Paul Moadib Uzul and Paul Moadib Atreides is so goddamn stark and uncomfortable. And I'm going to give it time. I'll be patient. But I have a feeling it's going to go down as one of my favorite performances of all time, because I was just blown away.
Yeah. He is incredible. And I think the biggest point you made there for me was that moment with him and Zendaya. They're falling in love. He's like staring at her lovingly. You see like the little smirk on his face. Like, that's Timmy. That's it great Timmy. Timothée Chalamet right there. Like,
Jasmine's great at it.
Jasmine's like giving me a nudge, looking at me like, this is awesome. She's talked to me about that scene like 50 times since watching it. Like, I'm in love with this guy. And I'm like, I know. I get it. I really do. I'm in love with him because of the second part, because of that turn. It is so damn good. And if you don't mind, Matt, it leads right into my first winner here, actually. It's Zendaya. And I would say it's like, I definitely know where Matt or Jack was saying with, he focused a lot on the Chalamet performance. This is Zendaya's performance, but also Chani. It is the character as well, because this is a long-awaited character performance. The biggest tease of Dune 1 was that Zendaya, you know, wasn't really in it much. She really wasn't in the movie at all. And getting her character in this film, because we didn't really know her yet. You know, we know she was a Freeman. We knew that there was, you know, she seemed fierce. It was Zendaya. They casted her for a reason. But I thought just her role as the voice of reason, and kind of being able to see through the shit, see through the game, and see through the lies and the deceit, and ends up being the victim at the end of this. And you feel gutted. You feel so bad for that. Final shot of the movie is devastating and gorgeous and incredible. Like, there are so many aspects of the final shot of the film that should win awards. How it looks, how it sounds, the performance, the themes of it, what it means, like how she's all alone now and she's just going back to basics, the parallels to earlier in the movie and to the first film. I could go on and on, getting chills talking about it. But I have to say, why I picked Zendaya and Chani both hand in hand is because I think a different actress would have came across as weaker than she should have. Chani is a badass, right? And even though she's devastated in the end, she still is kind of, she's stood on her morals. You know, she never really faltered. She never really gave into it. And I thought the performance was incredible. And I loved this new character. And Zendaya was, I mean, Chalamet, like, I'm glad Jack took that, said that first, because that is like the most obvious one, but also like the most important one. I thought Zendaya was such a standout to me leaving that theater and that character. I just loved everything about it, especially because I wasn't sure expectations wise. You know, she's a Freeman. She knows she's going to be the love interest. She's so much more than that. And I appreciate her so much for it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, what Zendaya was asked to do here is really important, because like we've known Zendaya for a long time. She's the biggest movie star in the world right now. Like, no one opens a movie like Zendaya. And, like, so much so that David doesn't want Spider-Man 4 to, like, do anything that No Way Home did. You know what I mean? Like David wants to ruin Spider-Man 4 because Zendaya opens movies. I'm never going to leave. I think it's a good one. I think it's funny. It makes me laugh.
And I don't know if David wants it. It made me laugh. David thinks that's going to happen.
Yeah, fair. I should change that a little bit.
Yeah.
but, like, she's asked to be the opposition. Not of Paul, like Paul's on her side the entire movie until the end, but be the opposition of the prophecy, but also fall in love with the prophet. And like, she does so much of both of those so well. The fact that like you buy that she is against what everybody is saying this kid is, but also you buy that they are genuinely falling in love, and they have so many scenes where they're talking about it too. Like, she is in his face, like, this is wrong, you shouldn't do this, this, that, the other. But in the exact same breath, it's like, you know, she loves this guy. And like, you really feel that. I'm not saying like their romance is one of the best movie romances I've ever seen, but like the epicness about it is so intense and so real. And Zendaya is just so good at doing that. I don't know what that is, but like, she just makes you feel whatever you're supposed to be feeling in such a big way. Like, there's so many moments when he announces that he's going to marry Florence Pugh, just the Jack, you said it, gutted. Just gut, no, David, gut it. You know what I mean? Just the heart, your stomach drops, and you feel that with Zendaya. To the moment where he rides the worm for the first time, and she smiles, and like this relief she has, like that's such like your shoulders drop just watching it, and it's so exciting. And then so like that's the performance, and then the other thing just on Shani, should have been Johnny. Would have been a very hot name if it was Johnny. I will say, because it sounds like Johnny. Am I wrong? Like, they could have said Johnny the whole time. Nobody would have known. Nobody would have known the difference.
Yeah.
But the thing about Johnny, like, the twist, and I've never read the books, but I've read up on what it's supposed to be. The twist in that she's against it all the way through the end and then leaves, it's a handoff of who the hero of the story is. And the fact that they give Zendaya that handoff, where like, now we're going to follow her. Now Paul's the enemy, and now it's Shawnee's opportunity to go back and beat the man she loves or whatever. Like, that it's earned, but it's earned because Zendaya makes it feel earned. And I think that it's having that dichotomy there the entire time is such an awesome thing. But it's just the balance of being the lover and the enemy the whole time without any of us even knowing it. I had no idea we were going to get the Vader thing here. I had no idea. No one told me. It wasn't spoiled for me. I had no idea Paul was going to go through with it in such a maniac kind of way, right? So when it happens, I'm like, well, what about Zendaya? And she doesn't budge, dude. She's still screaming at the top of her lungs how much bullshit this is. And I didn't see that coming either. So, like, it's just such a great thing for people who didn't see it coming. You get blindsided by all this epic storytelling. And it's just driven by this incredible performance by both of them together. But I think Zendaya is my MVP overall, just because she's so dynamic. Every single scene, every word she says has so many meaning behind it, but just because of the way she is.
I got to say, before you get to your winner, Matt, it is kind of crazy to me seeing their like interviews and all this press, and they're joking around. they've been sitting on these performances for a long time. They filmed this movie like 2022. And you have to think part of them was like, it's going to be crazy when the world sees this. Like they had to know what they had a little bit, right? Because like both of the performances we just discussed are, I mean, they are generational, upcoming young superstars with arguably both of their best performances in anything ever. I would say maybe Zendaya's performance is in Euphoria, but still, like these are two of their best performances on this grand stage, and they had to wait and it got delayed and they've been sitting on this. It's so crazy thinking they seem like, you know, really good friends. It's just awesome.
Yeah, I did just want to go off Zendaya real quick. Apparently, and I have not read the book Dune, but apparently one of the big changes from the book to the movie was that they made, well, I guess number one, Chani, she doesn't leave at the end, which
she's around as a side piece, an Olivia Pope of sorts.
Right. And they also make her part of the prophecy in this movie, which she was not, the whole Desert Spring thing. And
oh, right. Yeah.
And like, I love how they frame the tragedy of his downfall through her. And someone brought up a great point. Maybe it was someone we know, maybe it was in a group chat, I'm not sure. But like the fact that if you go back to Dune Part One, it opens with her voiceover, mm-hmm. and then you really see the full scope of this story and the tragedy of it. Yeah. Like, I think those changes were perfectly executed, making her more central to that tragedy and framing it through her eyes, because it's just powerful as shit.
It really is. And I had never thought of it that way. Like, they really tell the story of the prophecy through obviously all the maniacs about it, but also Zendaya. Like she is the yang to everybody else's yin. And it's just such an awesome way to do it, because she's the one that's closest to him. It's awesome. And dude, the Game of Thrones vibes, it's just so intense throughout this entire thing. And you know, more overarching statement, everybody who's like a Dune book fanatic probably hates Game of Thrones fans, right? Because like, well, you're Dune compared. Obviously, Dune inspired the books Game of Thrones. But without Game of Thrones being the biggest show that's ever existed, this movie doesn't get made, right? And I just love the inspiration inspiring itself and the snake eating itself over and over again. It's just so cool to see all the things we love about Game of Thrones being translated into this movie that was really the basis for all the things we loved about Game of Thrones. It's really cool just to see the, you know, the political sci-fi of it all come together in this amazing thing. And oh, also in the background is like our favorite thing ever, Star Wars. Like it's just very cool. And when you get these amazing actors and these amazing performances, that's what made Thrones so great. On top of all the storytelling was all the amazing performances. Star Wars, not known for its acting, but we fell in love with those characters. It all comes together here, I think, in Dune, in a very epic, not as fun, but just as like intense kind of way. Moving into my biggest winner, I'm struggling. Because like I want to take two, but I also don't want to steal something from you guys, but they really do pair together well. Is that cool?
Yeah.
Take two real
like
quick.
Two for one? Like you have
kind
two.
Of, but, okay. but it pairs a little bit here. And Rebecca Ferguson and Javier Bardem.
Oh, okay.
Obviously, like their individual, their individual performances and their individual characters, we can talk about separately. But just them framing the prophecy is just it's my favorite part of this movie, is the way the prophecy is laid out. And you've seen it on Twitter. It's everybody's favorite thing to, I think, quote from the original author. It's like the warnings of charismatic leaders, that kind of thing, right? And you see it so intently in Ferguson, who, guys, she is just
what a turn. What a turn in this movie.
She is striking the ball right on the screws every single time she shows up on my screen. She's incredible. But yeah, no, right away, I hate her. Like right away, I don't like this woman anymore.
Yeah.
And it's just such a, I didn't expect that. I didn't expect to feel that way. But to see her preach in such a maniacal, weird way, and to see Stilgar, Javier Bardem, already accepting all of that, he's grown up with this, be such a fanatic about it. The way that all comes together, and then the bottom just falls out, and all of this amazing work they think they've been doing, oh no, we actually won? That's a problem. Like, you know, be careful what you wish for kind of thing, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think so, like Rebecca Ferguson's performance instilled that so much in me, like the prophecy of it all. And but then you go to Javier Bardem. Did anybody expect to laugh as much as they did at this movie?
No.
No, right? Like I felt nervous. Like I leaned over to Aaron. I'm like, am I laughing? Like I felt like I wasn't supposed to be, but I was. So was. And it's so fucking genius by Denny or Javier or whoever decided to make this happen. To play that off as comedy for 90% of the movie was so genius, because it was so lovable and like, wow, look at this guy. The memes are going crazy right now. This, that, the other. But when the tipping point happens and you realize everybody in the crowd is Stilgar, that's a scary, scary moment when you realize they will do anything for this dude, including go to war with checks, notes, everybody. It's the jihad of it all came so fast and so quick. And even though we saw Paul kind of slowly do the Vader thing, when the fanatics, when the Stilgars of the world realized that he had passed that point, they were so in with zero hesitation. And that's the scariest part of this whole movie. And it's just, I thought it was so brilliant to play that character as so the comic relief, which this movie desperately needed. You know what I mean? It desperately needed a little levity.
Yeah.
To play that. And then, like, you know, to make him the kind of the representation of how bad this got, along with Rebecca Ferguson fueling the flame the whole time. And we can even bring in Gurney, you know, just kind of being like, yeah, dude, do it. Fuck it. You know, like, I just thought it was so amazing how they framed it all together and the momentum of it. And then, like a roller coaster, falls off. Just incredible.
Yeah. I completely agree. And it's cool we've all hit like actors' performances so far, because it's just so, it's so diverse. Each character is so different. And Javier Bardem, he was another one similar to Zendaya. He wasn't in the first movie, really. So you really didn't know what that character was going to give. And he was such a pleasant surprise for me.
Yeah, it's one of my notes here about blind fanaticism and worship, and turning humans with flaws, every human is flawed, every being is flawed, into mythic beings. And then when they embrace, that's true, dogs are pure Miss Peaches. Yeah. Shout out,
watch Coco, dude, damn.
apologies, just the humans, we suck. Turning us into mythic beings, and then if you get someone who embraces that, by far the scariest thing in this movie for me.
Yeah. And it happened so fast. He embraced awesome. It. Yeah. They didn't even flinch. They were like, yeah.
And it sucks but it's also great. Like, because you're rooting for Paul and you're rooting for these people and you kind of want to get behind them. It's like, yeah, they got some issues. Yeah, sure. But no, like, yeah, let's go. But then the moment happens, you're like, oh, wait a second. No.
Take it back.
Like, a holy war is starting where billions upon billions of people are going to die. Like, with the whole universe. Like, we imagine someone starting a war on this planet, and now picture that against the whole galaxy. The whole universe. Like, no.
And God, no. And I don't want to jump ahead too much into the movie. We don't do this chronologically, so
it doesn't matter.
I've been watching too much Kind of Funny. I'll say it. But never too much. They're good friends. But it's the way that, you know, he kissed the ring. I'm the guy, this, that, the other. Austin Butler's dead. And you get Gurney being like, hey, they've rejected it. They've rejected your ascension. And Stilgar looks at him and goes, what do you want to do? And it's what, take him to paradise or whatever?
Yep.
The pacing of that, it was 0 seconds in between. Hey, they rejected it. What do you want to do? Start a war?
Yep. One domino falls. The next one goes down. It's just
zero hesitation by the people following the orders, but also zero hesitation by Paul to give it. Just the second Gurney said that they're not accepting, okay, kill him.
Once he took the Powerade, like what, when he knew what the
so blue Powerade.
Oh, it looked delicious. That fetus, I'm their joy, well fed. When nutritioned up, strong. When he knew the way and the direction, like, there was no turning back at that point. There was no, like, that's, to me, it's like there was no hesitation. He saw the way. He saw the one way his whole family lives or whatever, you know, and boom, that was it. There was no hesitation. That was just it.
Kill everybody. You know,
and which
Yeah, the end game of it all. I mean, come on, dude. It's so good.
Well, that was such a twist for me, Matt. You mentioned it of they refuse to accept your ascendancy. I was thinking the exact opposite was going to happen.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, like this, it's going to be a shitty end. Like I was so lost. Who says that line?
Bernie.
Bernie.
Oh,
okay. Refuse to accept your ascendancy.
He's the one who knows the military protocol.
Right. Right.
He's the Atreides side of it.
Right.
Him and Jessica.
Yeah.
Another scary character. Oh my God.
Dude, you know what? And that's the thing. He's just like, yeah, finally, you know, like
yeah.
He's pumped.
And there's a specific moment where that happens. That leads right into my next winner, if I may.
Please.
My next, this is one is a little bit more unique. I saved it for the second winner, guys. Frank Herbert, the writer of the original Dune.
Yeah.
Because his disappointment with people's reception to Paul Atreides when the book came out, I think also when the 1984 movie came out, was that everyone painted Paul as a hero and in a heroic light. And the intention, as I'm sure most people know at this point, was for him to always be a cautionary tale and a dark figure. And I'm happy that this vision was finally realized, but also executed so damn well. And if you think about the white savior trope and how the book and the film goes against the typical heroic perspective of that trope and flips it on its head, like this is the danger of it. So Matt, you brought up a quote from Frank Herbert. I have one here, a little different one. He said, "Heroes are painful. Superheroes are a catastrophe. The mistakes of superheroes involve too many of us in disaster." Big fan of the Sokovia Accords for sure. Yeah. But what I love about the heel turn in Cautionary Tale, it doesn't just happen. You're so enveloped in the tragedy of it. Cause like I said earlier, you want to root for Paul and you think about his journey. He truly, midway through the movie, I'd say, he truly becomes Fremen. He takes on a Fremen name. Mm-hmm. He takes off his father's ring and he's proud of himself and he says, "Father, I found my way."
Yeah.
And becomes one with the people.
Was that before or after he got off of Zendaya? Or, okay, no.
It was after he rode the worm for the first time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was making a joke, by the way.
that also took me by surprise.
That a sex joke?
We don't do that.
The listeners that got it, they got it. Just keep going.
Anyway, before I was so rudely interrupted with the sex joke.
David's podcast. He can do what he wants.
That's true. What the fuck am I saying? David, do you want to finish my thought? No.
I don't know the quote.
That was an asshole.
He says it in the movie of he was friends with these people and now they're just followers. They're worshipers.
Mm-hmm.
So he became friends with them, but in order to fulfill the prophecy, to become the Lisan al-Ghaib, the voice from the outer world, he has to abandon his Fremen self, puts the ring back on, and that's when we get that scary fucking shot of Josh Brolin, like, going like, fuck yeah, let's go.
Yeah.
He's no longer Paul Moadib Uzzel. He's Paul Moadib Atreides. He shouted out, "Duke of Arrakis." And I just find that so interesting because it's a unique way of fulfilling this prophecy, if you will, and heartbreaking, because in order to lead the Fremen to paradise, according to the prophecy, in victory, he has to abandon being truly one of them. Like, and he uses power and fear and his position as a messiah to subdue them into this, like, no, I'm not one of you. You're gonna bow down to me. Like that scene when he's yelling at them, like, you think you could have a shot at me? You think you can stand against me? I know all your fears. And what if I actually am the one? You can't do it. And they all bow down. He's telling
that guy's
their
mind.
Dreams. Yeah, he's reading people's minds, telling them their dreams. And it's so starkly different from
like
how he was accepted.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
down like this with it. You know, like, so like come on, bring it.
Yeah.
he gets lower than them, gets below their level and is still standing over them somehow. Incredible. And that scene, leaning into your point, Matt, Javier Bardem in that scene, when he just, I mean, his face, that the facial expression he makes in that moment with his arms outstretched, just falling down, like, what do you want us to do? Or what will you do for us? It's just like, oh my God, I was so scared. And we'll get into this later, but like he becomes, shout out Star Wars, the very thing he swore to destroy. He
exactly.
becomes the emperor. He becomes Harkonnen. And it's just so sad.
Literally.
I love how Frank Herbert's initial vision which this came out in the 60s, but it's still so unique to us given all the other Chosen One prophecies we've gotten. It's such a unique way of telling this type of prophecy.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that because I wasn't expecting it.
Yeah.
If I may, I think all of that even just goes even further to how tragic the Chani character is too, because because for so long throughout this movie, too many names. I'm sick of him getting a new name every other scene. Hated that. But
I'm with you on that.
When he becomes Fremen, they start calling him Muad'Dib.
Uzul. Muad'Dib, yeah.
So, Chani calls him Uzul, his like personal name or whatever it is, right? Clunky's
unique name.
Yeah. And calls him Uzul and stuff because, like, you know, that's his guy. You know, they're homies. Like, they are a relationship. You know, like, and if anybody wants to talk to Paul, they know they got to talk to Chani first. You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing. And everybody calls him that. And she has that line that everybody's going to quote. As long as you're you, you're not going to lose me. Right? Calls him Uzul. Calls him Uzul. Everybody else is calling him Muad'Dib. This, that, the other. And I feel like Chani can see him kind of getting ahead of it a little bit. Like, hey, you know, reel it in. Reel it in. And then when I feel like when Chani feels like she needs to break through to him, what does she say? She calls him Paul Atreides. You are Paul Atreides. Like, goes back to that name. But she didn't realize that set off a emperor vibe in him. Like, you know what? I am Paul Atreides. I'm going to go take this fucking thing. And then she didn't realize that's what took. And then he comes out on the stage. And what does he say? I am Paul Muad'Dib Atreides. And it's the first time he calls himself that again in the entire movie. It's just, it's so perfectly, you know, it's fighting against itself the entire time until it gets to the breaking point. It's so fucking good.
You're so right, Matt. And let's add to the tragedy even more, something I didn't really think about that much. He didn't want to go south, and she's one of the people who says, no, we gotta go south. And mm-hmm. he was telling her, he's like, I can't go south. And and she ultimately, like, he has that vision. And that's something I want to bring up later in top plays, but like, and she comes over and it's like, hey, like, we got to go, just stay who you are. We'll be fine. And it's like, no, don't do it. It's like everyone just fed into this. Yeah. It's so sad. Like every time I watch this movie, I'm going to want a different outcome. And it's just, it's going to suck. Cause it's not going to happen.
It's really
two and three. Come on,
David. Do you have another winner for us?
Yeah. And this is going to be my third one, but I'm going to jump to it now because this will kind of continue our conversation here. And it was just the political, but mainly the religious themes of the movie. I thought they nailed these so well. The idea of false gods, false idols, you know, and specifically a false god, the prophecy, I thought was so interesting. Like, prophecy was planted by the Bene Gesserit missionaries as a protective tool, right? So they can manipulate the prophecy to gain assistance from the locals. Like, the fact that there was something at the very root of it that was just, I don't know, messed up, manipulated. Like, it was so interesting. I think as just an allegory, this movie, like, if you just take it just as that, like, just as something you want to compare to scripture, you know, the Bible, many other religious texts, and like where I would assume, you know, Frank Herbert initially pulled from, that then Villeneuve made into this movie. Like, there's so much that's cool there. I think specifically, if you just look at like Judaism, like, if you think about what, like, if you go back and read, all right, do your homework, kids, go to Sunday school.
No.
or don't, and just listen to this part of the podcast. And you think about like the Messiah figure, right? And like that, and like the coming, and like waiting for them. Like, there is this sense of like we're waiting for someone. And some people, typically called Christians, think that he came and then he died and then he left again. And some people don't think that's happened yet, right? And you think all these different things. And it was so fascinating to see in this movie, as someone who grew up reading, you know, scripture, the Bible, all these things. And I love these. And there's so many movies like this now, but I thought this one did such a great job because it is unabashedly, I would say, religious in many ways, like it, because of the prop, like it is, because it is the manipulation of religion. It is the idol, the god that is our main character. And there have been a lot of people like this, the allegory between like Anakin and like the Chosen One. It's a very obvious thing. this to me, I thought was so much more, maybe not well done, but it was so much more explained. Like, we're really seeing mm-hmm. how it works. And we talked about Stilgar. Stilgar is like the all-time character. If you're just focused on like the religious parts of the movie, of him being that blind follower, and Chani earlier, I mentioned like seeing through the lies, like seeing through where it could be manipulation. But then there are those that have so much faith, so much blind faith, and they just believe. There's the moment, it really stuck out to me when Chalamet still had his head, when Paul still had his ways about him, he can't go south. And there's this moment where they're arguing, him and Stilgar, and Stilgar's like, I don't care what you think. Like, I don't care what you believe. I think you are the one. And it's just, it's so crazy. And it all, we already mentioned it, but it all builds up to that moment at the end when it does flip. And we've already talked about this, but that moment of it flipping, when it goes from being a joke to being serious, and all of his disciples, and the fact that while they do have this like strong belief in the one, in like the chosen one, one thing that came to mind when like thinking about the podcast at the beginning of the movie, where you get all this great world building about how what they do with like their own, and when they die, mm-hmm. and you put them, you know, in like this pond or whatever you'd call it,
reservoir almost.
And it is a powerful scene. And you even see what they do with their enemies. They extract mm-hmm. their liquid from them. What are they doing at the end of the movie? They are just burning people. They're just doing what Harkonnens do. They are just lighting people on fire. And seeing that change, and seeing how the Fremen, and by the way, the North and the South thing, so cool. Like different parts. Oh, that was just like phenomenal. But seeing how they can still believe, like Stilgar, like he believes this is the way, this is the truth, this is, you know, his God or whatever, and he's the one. But then for some of his traditions and what he's believed his whole life to then switch, to then forget about, just because of that blind faith, so good.
As the guy said so.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because I put you on this pedestal, and because you said that, I thought that will be something, this movie, and I'm sure that the book's already been, this movie for like kids that are going to like film school, stuff like this, it's going to be studied just in that aspect, because I think it is just so expertly done. And there's so many parts of this we're going to talk about today, but Villeneuve just knew what he was doing in this movie. He just knew exactly what points to nail and how to, I haven't read the book, none of us have, how to make this story something great for the big screen. And I think he nailed that. Like you mentioned earlier, Jack, how, I think it was Jack, how like Chani was then put into the prophecy, and mm-hmm. that being a switch. And I think it's a very cinematic move, I would say.
Yeah. It gives her a moment too, which is always great.
It connects them. Yeah.
I think that, like, I don't get political on this podcast, and I don't get political about many things in my life. But the one thing I'm very passionate about politically is the people who will use their religion as an excuse to act certain ways. I'll mm-hmm. leave it at that. Right. Mm-hmm. It's something that bothers me to my core.
Yeah.
But like, it's exactly what you just said. Like, people will completely pivot just because the guy said so. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting to me that the Bene Gesserit are the people who are driving all of this, because what is their superpower? The voice. How does the voice work? You use your certain abilities to control people. And it gets to a point where what is more powerful than control? Belief. You can't use the voice on an entire group of people, but if they believe you, you are the voice now. Now it's just whatever you say anyway. And how, and who planted all of that belief? The Bene Gesserit. It's the voice on a grander scale.
Right.
It's like their master plan almost the entire time. But who wasn't pulling the strings exactly when it actually happened? The Reverend Mother. Who gets told to shut the fuck up? The Reverend Mother. Really excited so about it? Who's really excited about her being told to shut the fuck up? Austin Butler, which is just a crazy fucking shot. When he yells at her, and Austin Butler's like, ooh.
Yeah, I like that. Like, yeah.
He's so good. On, man.
Dude, it's so... It's just, the levels is just amazing, and it's tragic, and it's just horrible. It's a really sad movie, man. And
it is. It is.
It's just really awesome to watch. If I may.
Yes, please.
Is anybody going to say Austin Butler next?
No, actually.
You are?
I wasn't, no.
Was it? Okay, I'll do him here then.
Yeah.
I just think he, as much as like, I don't think he played into the story much where so many other characters do. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? What a presence this guy was. You know what I mean? Like what a force he was every time he stepped on screen. Obviously, what they did with his world was insane. Just fucking insane. One of the coolest things I've ever seen in a movie in my entire life.
Yeah.
And for that not to be in a Marvel movie before is insane. Like Thor Love and Thunder was. Like, that was also incredible, the black and white stuff they did there. Like that was amazing. And we talked about it when we reviewed that movie. That's the best part of that movie. The way they took that idea and made it like a whole world, yeah. like their whole personality almost, you know what I mean?
Right.
Really great. And just Austin Butler is a presence, and you know, like his movements, his facial expressions, all that stuff. Being able to sound like Stellan Skarsgård is such a, like, one of our favorite voices as comic book fans. Like, Stellan Skarsgård's our guy, like, as Star Wars fans, to sound like him in a scarier way. Come the fuck on. So yeah, I just want to. I just feel like my other winner is going to be Scale, but we'll talk about that more in top plays. I feel like, but yeah, Austin Butler just presence. You know, like I his character, I don't think is a winner, but him, I think Austin Butler is a winner. I will be excited in everything I see him in moving forward. I didn't like Elvis. Love Austin Butler now.
When I saw this movie, I thought of that meme, that Shaq meme. I'm sorry, I wasn't really familiar with your game, because Elvis was great.
Me and Leah Sandu, I will say.
I really liked Elvis. I've liked it less and less as I watched it a couple more times. And his performance is great, specifically the last 20 minutes, but a lot of it is just looking pretty and fitting in those Baz Luhrmann shots. And also, of course, the stage presence, which is a whole nother thing. But in the quiet moments was kind of what I was missing. This was just something else entirely. Like, holy shit. I mean, the introduction to him, it's like, okay, like, we all know what's coming. It's like, all right, here we go. We're into this. But I didn't know how into this we were going to get.
Yeah.
He has...
comic book as fuck.
It is. He has pets, what he calls pets, or his darlings, that are cannibals.
Dude.
And kinda they're hot, so too.
They're so freaky, man. Like, I... And also, it was such a, speaking of that whole world, and that's, well, we'll get to that in top place. But
you want the liver or the spleen?
Oh my God. And the tongue thing, the knife.
My darlings, they haven't eaten in a while.
He improvised a decent amount, including the knife on the tongue, which is like, okay.
And this, which was really
and
great.
Kissing. Yeah. I thought that was actually powerful. Dude. Anyway,
yeah, it great performance. I'm he has a movie coming out this year called The Bike Riders with Tom Hardy that I am very excited for it now.
It looks even more so
excited for it than I could have been. Looks good. It looks great.
Sons of Anarchy meets Lawless.
It's true. All right, is it my turn?
Are
we going to my next winner? All right. This one, I don't even know how much there is to say about it, especially because I feel like it's going to take up top place. But it has to be said in winners because he is a winner of this movie, and that's Greg Frazier, director of photography.
Oh yeah,
God,
yeah.
I mean, he did the Batman, did the Mandalorian season one.
He did the Batman.
He did do the Batman. Yeah, yep. And he's done other stuff. I don't have the full list,
guy.
But he is
color.
Unbelievable. And so apparently for the sequence on, I think the planet's just called Harkonnen. I could be wrong about that.
No. But, Getty Prime.
Thank you.
Yeah.
For that whole black and white stuff. So I guess Denis had gone to Greg Frazier and said, I want to do this in black and white, make it feel very alien. And they used, I'm not even going to act like I'm a tech genius on this. I'm just going to say it. They used like an infrared lens, I guess, that made it stand out. Like, it didn't just make it black and white like we've seen in many other movies before. It does something else. And I don't know what it was that it made different, but it made something different, Matt.
It's inverting it and then recoloring that. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of people will color something and then put a black and white on it and then like go from there. They inverted it first and then brought it back to production level off of that. And that's why when Baron Harkonnen walks out, his black robe turns to white. Like, it's not just making things black and white. It's inversing the color of things and then bringing a black and white effect in. It's fucking amazing.
Yeah.
So, and I noticed that when the Bene Gesserit ladies were walking into, that's yes. when I really saw the black to white. Oh my God. Dude, well, that whole sequence is incredible.
On that planet too. It's cool how when they're inside, there is color. It's only when you're under the sunlight, you know, and it's so cool.
The walkout was fucking insane.
And, to me, like, in not a technical way, it just looked devoid of light. Not like they were coloring it, but just like there just like wasn't any. Like it did genuinely, however they did it, it felt like it was whatever a black sun would do, where there's heat emanating, but there's not this golden light. Yeah.
Yeah. Sky did Rogue One.
You also did The Creator, which just recently came out, which is a really good looking movie for like the budget that it had
for $80 million.
This had an $190 million budget, which isn't that crazy. Like all these Marvel movies we watch are more than that. So it's just crazy, like what they were able to do with the budget.
Yeah,
yeah,
I agree.
And what I love about his work here specifically is that the camera work and the lighting, the visuals, it's its own character in the movie, and it adds so much depth. I said it earlier, like these things are codependent. I don't believe Chani and Paul's love as much if it doesn't look so goddamn gorgeous too.
Beautiful.
Like there's a specific pan down or like it's almost like a pan up and you just see the vast landscape. It's like, oh my God, like you get swept up in it. And like I said earlier, you're just brought into this world.
We needed the Frank Attack Frazier. Of the Clones music right there.
Dude, they had
good music. A theme.
They had a love theme.
Yeah.
Quiet Time Between Storms, I believe it's called.
It was triumphant. It was beautiful. It was inspiring because usually a love theme is more of a down note because those are the sweeter, softer moments. But this was like a heroic thing. But you notice they use that theme when he sends everybody off to war
at the end.
It makes me so sad. It's amazing, dude. I used to think the black hole grenades from Thor Dark World was the coolest thing I've ever seen in a movie.
Those were cool.
Still undoubtedly just so fucking cool.
Yeah.
Ink blot fireworks? Dude.
I love that.
Genius.
It was amazing.
Something out of an animated, like an anime or like an animated movie. Yeah.
Yes, I've never seen them, but it felt like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. It really did. I don't know what that That's is, awesome. But it felt like it.
Lord and Miller.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It is Lord and Miller. No. The cinematography, the top-down shot of him walking through the crowd every time a worm shows up.
Oh, holy shit. The best shot of the movie.
Can we talk about the worm now?
Before, this is a worm shot. I'm not sure you're talking about the same one. When it's dark and it's just Paul walking in his cloak. And he's just like black, and then like the black worm comes out. That was the shot of the movie to me. That's
from the distance.
Yes, and he's just walking up. I'm like, holy shit! That shot was what they wanted you to feel in Revenge of the Sith. That really was. Like, yeah. I'm like, holy crap! Like, it's all because the worm it changed. It's similar, right? It's like all these positive powers and abilities. What happens when that flips? What happens when that changes? And that was, and look, Denis Villeneuve has been very, kind of hilariously, basically been like shitting on dialogue words lately. But he makes a great point because we just talked about inkblot fireworks and he said that he wants people and he thinks himself, like when he watches a movie, it's the images that stick with him, less of like, you know, the words, the dialogues, the writing, which, you know, is.
I'm the opposite.
Right. But in this movie, the visuals are so awesome. Those will stick with you. And it was awesome to have a director like that with a project like this, it's the part two, a new sci-fi world create this, right? This is now our Dune visual. For us that haven't read the books, this is Dune. This is what it looks like. This is what it feels like. This is what it is.
It's got to be what the Harry Potter fans felt like.
You know what I mean? Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, good point.
Like the first time you see the school, like if you had read the books at that time, that had to be such a moment for you to like, because that's such an iconic and amazing shot. The first time they ride up on the school, that had to be such a feeling.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Oh, this is what it is. And like, oh, it's just so
John great. Williams. Yeah.
I I mean, Denny's cooking. He's the hottest thing in the world right now. He'll be able to make any movie he wants for the rest of his life, I think, especially if this makes as much money as it feels like it's going to. We will cover the box office next week. We're running a little long. I think we spend a whole 20-30 minutes on box office. Yeah, David?
Yeah, for sure. And then we'll have a better idea next week. Big time, actually. It'll be very interesting weekend, too, how it performs.
At week two is going to be insane. I feel I'm like we talk about that every time we talk about box office is week two.
Well, it's critical these days. I mean, it's the Marvel thing where it's, you know, it opens so hot and then how quickly will it cool down?
Denny, I understand you're the hottest in the world. What fight are you fighting right now? Who are you trying to stop from having words in their movies?
I don't know.
You had a great writer with you on this movie. Let him cook. I don't get who this is for.
And it's a well-written movie.
It's so weird to think about. I'm pretty sure he co-wrote Prisoners, which is such a Sorkin-ass movie.
Oh, but some great visuals in that one too.
Well, sure.
Like, gee whiz. Yeah, it was such a weird comment, but I do get what he's saying. You want the shot to be able to tell the story alone. Yeah. And they do that very well, the shot you just mentioned, David. But yeah, it was a weird hill to die on.
I think the point is fair, and I have no idea this is what he was trying to say. It's a movie, not a book. And in literally, like this, you're recreating a book. Like you is an adaptation. So it should be the visual that is, you know, sticking with you because you can just read the book, you know? And I think that's what's so unique. We talk about like Dune and Star Wars. A lot of people have been making those comparisons all of a sudden because after this movie, they're realizing what the stories act like, the you know, how the stories are similar. And Star Wars was never a book, you know? And that's such a big thing with that. Like we mentioned, like Harry Potter and now Dune and all these things. Like Lord of the Rings. Star Wars was always just Star Wars. It was always just that. There was never like Tobey Maguire doing Spider-Man. Holy shit, that's like popping off the comic page. So it's just interesting when you're comparing these things because they're not all the same. And their backstories are not all the same either.
Star Wars is forever that first shot when we see this Star Destroyer go over the screen. You know what I mean? Like the moment that happens, you're in. Like it doesn't take much more than that to buy into Star Wars.
And that's what I love about this preconceived
notion to it.
That's what I love about Star Wars, Back to the Future. They came from nothing. They're inspired by X, Y, and Z. You know, Star Wars was inspired by Dune, but they were just a movie. And that's what's so interesting. In the future, I wonder how much, like Dune's an incredible adaptation. Like, this is an incredible adaptation. But I just wonder, like, how many more first-time, creative, original concepts we'll get from creators like Villeneuve.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. David, do you have a last one for us here?
Yeah, I had a quick one because we've pretty much, like, at this point, we talked about a lot. But mine was just, I want to hit a few bullet points, was world building. Because I thought the first movie did a good job, and this one did a great job. I thought the world building was so awesome. First off, you begin the movie, we get the Emperor. And this was this guy that we just heard about. We get Florence Pugh's character, his daughter. And it's like, okay, we're getting... We actually get more of an idea. And even at the end, it's like, oh, there's all these, like the eight other houses, I believe it is. It's like, oh, okay. You know, there's all these other people that are coming. And maybe in the next movie, we'll learn more about them. We in the first movie, it's like, who are these witches? What is this crazy voice thing? Like, what is Rebecca Ferguson doing? In this one, we get more of an idea of like who they are, the Bene Gesserit, who they are, what they're up to. And then I already touched on this earlier. Well, we already talked about Austin Butler and his planet. Like, that was all amazing. But the Fremen with the North and the South and all of that, because we spend so much time with them in this movie. And that whole beginning of the film, like, is just so great. And we spend so much time. We learn so much about that. I thought all of that was just wonderfully done. Like, the world building in this movie, I thought was just expert, especially when I would say one of my critiques in Dune Part 1 was there wasn't enough of that. Like, it really felt like there was like this big universe and world, and we were looking through a very small little hole in Dune Part 1, where in this one, it really starts to expand in a major way.
It's interesting. I'm not the opposite on it, but I think Dune Part 1 did so much great world building that this one didn't have to do as much, but I agree with you in that the world building it did was so deep. Dune Part 1 introduced a lot of different things. This one narrowed it down
and
went deep. Dune.
Right.
It was like Dune Part 1, broad brush. Dune Part 2, fine tooth comb.
Yeah, exactly. It feels like we know so little in Dune 1, it feels like. Looking back, it's like we just know so little. And yes, we're on the Atreides' first planet. I forget what it's called, which is beautiful in this one when it's meant. He's like, yeah, and like, there's this wave.
I don't believe you.
Over the ocean.
Dude,
oh,
what a
my
fucking
gosh.
Spider-Man moment that was, dude. So
I loved that. So good on camera together. Zendaya and Timothy
She's
Chalamet.
She's good with everybody.
That's
good
true.
With every single person. Mm-hmm.
And it's, by the way, seeing these people like ask about them kissing on screen and like blah, blah, and like being. I couldn't believe
job,
I couldn't believe that. Like, that's, you get time to ask Timothy Chalamet a question. And you're going to ask about if it was basically awkward to make out with Zendaya. No, no.
Wild.
Why is that the question you asked? That was so...
I will walk outside and make out with your mom right now if I want to. I'm Timothy Chalamet.
Oh, I love Timothy
I will
Chalamet.
Say about the world building between part one and part two. Part two made me appreciate the world building of part one on a level I didn't beforehand.
I'm so
it,
happy
that, I, that's kind of how I approached it, because I remember watching Dune Part 1, or just Dune at the time, for the first time. I was like, all right, like, it's a lot. Like, I'm kind of like all over the map here. I didn't
so
really
much.
Like it that much. Yeah. And then on the rewatch, I'm like, oh, shit, this is really good. And then after Part 2, it's like making so many different connections. Paul's visions, there's one particular clip where he sees the vision of the Holy War in Part 1.
Yeah.
And God, that scene means so much more now. Because, like, you get it. You get why it scares him.
Yeah.
So world building, excellent in this movie.
Yeah.
It's all very, very good. All right. Losers. Do you guys have losers?
I do.
Jack, you said perfect movie.
I did say perfect movie.
I say that a lot, though.
it is one of those things, Matt. You did say it off the top, though, after I said that, of like, any faults that this movie does have is just completely overshadowed by how great it is. It's not even a fault. It's just kind of like I wasn't expecting that was Dave Bautista's character. Yeah. I liked how they played him. It's just.
He's Drax from Guardians 1.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's one of the things I've seen it before in a way. He is a little bit more of a bitch. I mean, and I was surprised.
And they make him that right away.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
They do. They 100%.
They don't give us a chance to like him.
Right. And so that's why it's not a fault. It's just kind of like he's there sometimes. And I like the stuff that they were trying to go for, but I would have maybe liked a little more of it. So
I feel like the internet says that they do characters dirty anytime that their favorite character isn't the main character. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I feel like they did do Bautista dirty here a little bit. You know what I mean? Like he just instantly made him a simp and a bitch. And it's unfortunate because he was such... The Baron is the best villain of these two parts, I think. And the Baron in part one, I think, is the best villain overall, in my opinion. I know Austin Butler's great, but he's great because of his action, not because of his character, right? Bautista was this mysterious, like, me. And throughout this movie, he's breaking people's necks. He's smashing people's skulls. Right. But the second Austin Butler shows up, we do not care for a second. Anything Bautista says, does, or... you know, is around. Like, I was shocked he was around at the end of the movie. I'm shocked they didn't kill him. You know what I mean? So, like, you know, that's kind of, I just think he didn't have any room to do anything. I don't think it's Bautista's fault what happened to the character.
Not at all.
He got, honestly, to me, though, it just didn't give us any range with Bautista. They just did, they did, like, the kind of very basic Dave Bautista thing. Like I said, Guardians 1, like, angry guy that looks like he could, like, just snap someone's neck, so he does.
Nothing goes over my head. I would catch.
Yeah, so good. See, that was what was missing though. Like it was
genuinely hilarious.
It was all like the like rocky, hard shelled, you know, crust part, and none of like that. I had one big loser in my opinion, and it's the pacing. This movie's pacing, I think, is wild. I mean, if you, so I wanted to break this down a little bit because Denis Villeneuve had to sit there and be like, all right, I'm going to make a part one and a part two. Where am I going to cut it? I think it makes sense where he breaks. Looking back, retrospectively, definitely. I think it does make sense where he breaks. Specifically with Rebecca Ferguson's character. Because she is polar opposite from movie one to movie two. And I thought, I'm like, she must have been thought about when they were breaking this. Because the turn doesn't happen until the very beginning of this movie. What a creepy scene, by the way, with the prior Reverend Mother. Or whatever. That was so scary.
Oh, yeah.
Like her real.
Yeah. She's with child. Yeah. Or whatever she says. No, I think so. This movie's pacing to me was just all over the place. And I think on a second watch, it's going to be interesting because in the first one, it felt jarring because the beginning of the movie feels extended. It feels stretched out. And then when you get to Austin Butler, finally, it's just full throttle. It just feels like we're just moving so quickly. And like time is moving like kind of randomly. I feel like there's like sometimes there's like jumps in time. And specifically, I would say the ending to me has some flaws in its pacing. Specifically, when it is time for Paul to go south, that is like instant. Like we get a jump cut to him walking into that room to drink the what is it called?
The water
liquid, water of life. I was gonna say liquid of life. Water of life.
How they get it out and everything.
So yeah, good. Yeah. But like, because we get the setup of how it works, and then like later in the movie, because Rebecca Ferguson, we get more of a journey for her going south. And then when it's time for him to go south, he's just there. And he's by himself, walking in there by himself with just him and the lady. It's like, wait, what? Like, that's crazy. You're already here. And I remember thinking, like, while watching, I'm like, this movie's been going on for a long time. Mm-hmm. It's going to start wrapping up here soon. Like, what's going to happen? You know?
You got TV feeling.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, like how does this end? So yeah, the pacing to me, it was my only criticism because I don't know how you do it differently. And I think oftentimes the pacing can be very tricky when you're adapting a book. We've seen this time and time again, when you make a part one, a part two, even if you don't do that, you're cutting things, you're cramming things, you're trying to make it work. Cause even books, novels from chapter to chapter within a chapter, they sometimes do kind of do that time jumping maneuver. Like they kind of like skip time. And I think when it's done in a movie, it doesn't work as great sometimes. So I just think in general, the pacing was up and down and a little bit all over the place.
If I can, Jack, yep, that does kind of play into my loser is that like, I feel like I agree with you. The pacing was up and down. The issue I think that made it feel a little weird. And again, it does pay off for me at the end when it is moving so fast to the point where it's, hey, they don't want you to be king. Okay, kill them all. Like, it's so fast at the end that it makes it that much more unnerving when he's making such quick decisions after he does the Doctor Strange thing. But my problem with it was in the back half of the movie, anytime we took a pause in pacing was to reveal something. And the three things they decided to reveal in those pauses, I felt were all kind of lame a little bit. The Desert Spring thing, while a great scene and a great moment, felt kind of forced in that, like, okay, that's the first time we're hearing about this. Like nobody had mentioned that before. And like she says it, and then Javier Bardem's like, oh, Desert Spring. Yeah, of course.
It wasn't though. So when he asks her what her name means, because he gets named Uzel and it means something. He asks her, what is your name? And I forget the actual name. And he's like, what does that mean? And she goes, Desert Spring. It's from some old prophecy that I don't care about.
She like hates it.
So,
yeah.
Say that again, David.
She hates it, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. She hates it. And he goes, then I hate it too.
Yeah. That's a cute moment.
Oh, see, I didn't catch that line where she mentioned it's from a prophecy. So yes, it's more of a reveal that it's this prophecy.
Right.
Yeah, she didn't clarify what prophecy it was or anything.
No.
All the way back in might be my favorite part of the movie.
It's a payoff. Yeah.
The other two things though. The Family Atomics, we take a beat to talk about the Family Atomics, and we have that whole scene. It's cool seeing the gang together. You know what I mean? It's a cool, again, that's a comic book as fuck scene. But that felt very just out of nowhere. You know what I mean? And like a weird place to put that in the movie. We're going to do this quick Atreides side quest. You know what I mean? Out of nowhere. And then the I'm Your Father moment. As cool as it is, Star Wars did it so much better. In that him realizing he's a Harkonnen, Jessica Ferguson had a great line. I didn't know it until I drank it either. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't know. I didn't expect that at all. And then he goes up and kills him. He would have done that anyway. You know what I mean? It didn't change anything. Him being a Harkonnen changed nothing. And that's a bummer for me because it has such an I'm Your Father vibe, but it really doesn't do anything. Whereas when I'm Your Father actually happens, what it does to Luke in the next movie is you know, monumental, you know, how it turns Luke into this, okay, I'm going to fix him now kind of guy. It doesn't really have an effect on Paul in this movie. He would have gone up and stabbed him anyway.
And I disagree with you a little
bit. No, I'm right. Okay. You're wrong. Let's move on.
It's a fun show, guys. Well, Matt, and because I did ask you about this. We were texting about it after you saw it. And I don't know if I knew I was going to be on the pod yet, but I was like, we'll talk about it another time. Because I had seen it a second time and I agreed with the first time I saw it. I completely agreed because plot wise, it doesn't change anything. You're 100% right. Thematically, though, after seeing it a second time, there's a line where he's like, we're Harkonnens. But he goes, and that's how we're going to survive by being Harkonnen. So I think thematically, plot-wise, doesn't change anything. He kills the Baron, whatever. He doesn't use the power of House Harkonnen to do anything in particular. But thematically, within his mind, it's like, after he drinks the Water of Life, it's pure political power that he's after. Hmm. And basically drowning out his heart. Yeah. In order to drown out his heart for just this political gain and for political victory across the galaxy and universe, whatever, like that's just the way I saw it. I think because when he said that line, I was like, okay, what's that going to mean? And after the first time, I was like, okay, it didn't really mean anything. What does he mean? We'll survive by being Harkonnens. And that's the only way I can rationalize that line of like, he embraces just being, I don't want to say pure evil, but just like power hungry and forget ruthless. Everything else. Ruthless is perfect. Abandons Chani and says, you know, I'm going to abandon the real love of my life so I can have this political marriage in order to rule the universe.
Yeah.
That's just kind of how I saw it.
And that's a really great way to reframe it because it's back to the, who's the author?
Frank Herbert.
It's back to the whole, this is the opposite of every other superhero thing. Cause, you know, Spider-Man.
Come on.
Huh?
Tom Holland.
No. I'm trying to think of like, what's another hero that just like, we're never going to give up. We're never going to stop trying kind of thing. He does stop trying. He stops trying to make it work. He just, this is what it's going to be. Let's just do it. You know what I mean? Fuck it. You know? Yeah. And he, Timothy Chalamet is so good. At, like you can tell he does feel sorry with Chani. No one else does he feel sorry for at all.
Yeah. What's the line, by the way? As long as I breathe, I'll still love you. Something like that.
I love you as long as I breathe. Which made me think he was going to die, by the way.
and that's what every other movie would have done. Every other movie, he would have found a way where everybody else survives but him. But he's like, nope, I got to be here too. You know what
to
I mean?
To me, that made me think like there's going to be some sort of like pen pal thing going on. Like where it's like, all right, I'll be over here. But you know, like we can still meet up on the weekends. I don't know,
hot,
like
sexy. Yeah. but no, and again, it's back to that dichotomy where it's for Chani, it's as long as it's who you are, I'll still love you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But with Paul, it's as long as I'm still breathing. Doesn't really matter who I am. You know what I mean? Like, and that's what's so sad and great point up about it.
Yeah.
It's no, but Jack, twice you've turned me on two of my losers, but I still think the Family Atomics was kind of lame.
Yeah, that was kind of.
Oh my god! When he just starts firing at a mountain for no goddamn reason. Oh wait, what's the reason? So the worms could get it. Come
right,
on.
Right. Well, yeah, and I guess you know it didn't bother me that scene in the movie just because of what you said, Matt. It's so comic booky and the gangs together and whatnot.
Yeah.
But I think it's also just another thing to push Paul to like, am I going to have to use these atomics? Am I going to have to embrace the power? Embrace Atreides? So
it's pretty cool when he threatens it at the end. And it everyone's is. Like, wait,
oh, dude,
wait, really, what?
He's bluffing.
yeah.
Awesome. All right, guys, let's move into the top plays. A little more rapid fire here. We're going very long.
Yes.
But hey,
expected.
Once in a lifetime, man.
What a movie, dude.
Yeah, I was going to say.
This is who would like to go first? I have mine in semi-chronological order.
I do not.
Okay. The opening scene.
I don't think I do.
Floating Harkonnens. And then the dropping Harkonnens.
That's what I'm falling off the cliff. Yeah.
Whoa. What a way to open a movie. And then we get a little hand to hand with Paul there too. Come on. So good.
Talk about the sound design in that, Matt. Like the sound design of them falling and going up when they get shot. Oh my God.
So great. So great.
Amazing. Great scene.
All right, Jack.
Vision.
Sorry.
We gotta get that in there. Sorry, mine's not on chronological order, so I'm going to go all over the place here. Please. But the vision of Jamis when he's trying to decide whether to go south. And when I read this on fucking Twitter or a Screen Rant article, whatever it was, of that, because Jamis, he sees visions of Jamis in the first movie, and I never understood that. I didn't understand it here the first time. And right. It's the idea that he's seeing an alternate reality where he didn't have to kill Jamis, and that they're friends, and he's the one teaching him all the friendly ways.
Yes.
I love that. And he's the one who tells him, like, who kind of the final nail in the coffin, you have to go south because you have to see. Like, a good hunter climbs the highest dune in order to see. You have to see. I loved how that connected to Dune Part 1 and just connected in my brain.
Being able to pick and choose who he gets advice from and when. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I'll mention a couple here. I already mentioned the Pond of Souls. Not going to mention that anymore. That was awesome. And then two that kind of go together. I just wrote down, it was also in the first one, but the use of lasers, the way they look, the way they sounded, the way they just, that genuinely looked like the future of like weaponry. And then on top of that, it kind of goes hand in hand with like weaponry, was the scene with Zendaya and Chalamet taking down the helicopter and like and then the ship, and they're like, they have to use like the shadows, like stay under the wing and like reload, doom, reload. Oh my god, like Zendaya's
turn around, hit the guy anyway.
Yes, that was so badass. That was the most like comic book movie. Oh shit, like that was awesome. Like I'm giggling because that was so much fun. That was such a top play for me because I could watch that all over.
The shot where she shoots it and she's like laughing, running, like so happy they shot it down. It's completely quiet, just her running. And then in the background, it falls and crashes. The music starts blaring. Oh my god,
that's not the most incredible shit, dude.
it totally is.
But even in that same scene, when he has the plan, like, okay, I'm gonna run. I'm gonna distract him. And then
they have to shoot in order for the shields go down
when they shoot. I know. You know what I mean? So he starts running and then the thing starts moving and he says, Oh shit. Like, I don't know what it is, but him saying shit right there was like, oh yes.
Yeah. It felt out of the universe. It was just like that.
It gave me an MCU feeling. I didn't think I was going to get this movie, but it was like, oh shit.
I love that scene.
Like, it was very cool. Yeah. Great scene. Great. Fucking, anytime they raided a spice miner, just fucking awesome. Yeah. Overall, hand-to-hand combat in this movie was incredible.
And like the way they can pop it out of the ground, just the way the Fremen stuff. Like fight. It's just really cool. And they're so scary. It's that one scene. It's just like terrifying. They're just so scared of them, and it's like all dark. So good. Mm-hmm.
Leading up to that scene, he gets told you need to walk across the desert. Shani, flirty little bitch. She's like, fuck him. He's fine, whatever. I'm definitely gonna go hang out with him though. You know what I mean? It's the first time he's been alone since he got here. What a fucking moment.
And I loved how it was like she follows, but he's still going on the journey. She's just kind of like watching. She's just there.
Teaching him how to do the dance. And that's very interesting. In my textbooks, it's just like, you fucking nerd, shut up.
In the film, film library or whatever, the film books he's been watching.
I'm trying to fuck, you're being a nerd. but in that moment though, once they start the walk and we get a little sequence of him becoming a Fremen, guys, it's a montage. I didn't think we were going to get a montage in this movie. Yeah. You don't get montages like that in movies anymore. You really don't. Like, if it's a montage, it's usually like right before something's about to happen. This was like I feel like a lot of the criticism we see in this movie, David, you even had it as far as the pacing. He becomes Fremen very quickly. They fall in love very quickly. No. Montage. Time has
montage solves everything.
Time has passed. Yeah, it's so funny. The riding the worm scenes, it made me feel the way when Tom Cruise is going off the ship and he takes off.
Yeah.
That's how the worm thing felt. It felt so, it took my breath away. Oh. I was so just like my chest was tight watching it. Like maybe I need to go, but like it was so incredible how long it was, dude. It was amazing.
Yeah. When I saw this movie, or Part 1, re-release in IMAX a few weeks ago, they showed this scene afterwards, and it was so cool watching it again. And just it's an incredible scene. It's one like that is
perfect
when Paul is most a hero, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, and that is really when he is most like the good guy hero. Nothing could go wrong at that point.
And I love Hans Zimmer being like, okay, we need to, we're going to be on this worm for so long. We need to let the audience know when he's done it. So we'll let the screeches happen when he,
yeah, dude, it's so good. It plays.
Well, and I will say though, when Stilgar's doing it in the distance and he's doing the wave,
I was going to figure
out. Kind of funny, said it first. David, what does it remind you of when he's doing the wave?
Yeah, wait, what does it remind me of?
Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Oh,
the tiny bit.
Yes.
Maybe the tiny bit will save
us. I'm like, wait, what is that? That's so funny.
He was this tall? God. Well, you know, perspective.
That's amazing.
Kurt Russell waving on the thing.
Yeah. That's awesome.
It was very goofy. It was
weird,
extremely goofy.
Weird way they did that. It was like, hey, what's up?
Oh, my God. Jack. That's so funny. Two quick ones here. The scene after Paul rises from the dead, the camera stays on Rebecca Ferguson, and all of a sudden you see the day transform into night around her, but she's just doing like, I don't know how they did it, but like everything she's doing stays the same. She starts walking and just all of a sudden it's like a transition. It's like someone has like a switch and it goes from night to day very quickly. And all of a sudden it's a new scene and Timothy's sitting by the pond thinking about all the different alternate realities. I thought that was so cool.
They do that shot at T2. It's fucking awesome. I don't know how they do it either.
I still need to see that movie.
So good.
The other one, God, Christopher Walken. Let's talk about him. I killed your father because he basically said he wasn't the type of man made to lead. Why? Because he was a man of the heart. And I was like, oh shit. And Paul is no longer a man of the heart.
Yeah.
It's like, fuck, I didn't get like that line initially. It was just like, oh, Christopher Walken's so good. But then I was like, oh, that line means a lot. Mm-hmm. And then of course it leads to fucking badass fight.
And the Reverend Mother follows it up when Florence Pugh's like, you instructed my father to kill him, or like you advised. And she's like, no, we don't advise. We plan.
We plan, do. Right?
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, of course I did. It's a chess piece. Like, oh, did it happen? Yes, I was a part of it. It's so Thrones, dude. It's so Thrones. David?
One of the biggest top plays for me, and I'm surprised you haven't mentioned it yet, I don't think we have, is when the fight and specific shot is recreated with Zendaya. That was Timothy Chalamet in part one, and it is absolutely incredible. When she turns and the shield kind of goes up and she's got the knife, I'm like, wow. That,
so I knew Paul was fucked.
That was incredible. Yeah, that was just so cool seeing that parallel and the recreation of that shot this time with Chani. That was amazing.
Such a great part of that movie.
Yeah, and yeah, like the visions and like the visions becoming real and not. It's just so cool. And
he hasn't had a single vision that was like actually what ends up happening, except for the religious war. But who's with him in the war? Zendaya.
Yeah.
No, it's gonna be Florence Pugh.
Exactly.
Like, so good,
dude.
Yeah.
Shit. So good. Yeah.
Last gonna be such a fuck, dude.
It's gonna... I cannot wait.
I need this guy to die so bad.
I'm very curious how they're gonna adapt it from the stuff I've heard.
I have no idea what happens.
I'm happy for you, Matt.
Yeah.
A big top play for me, and I actually don't know if it'll be a top play for you guys because I heard some people not really liking it. The twist at the end of the fight with he gets stabbed, and I genuinely know there's a third book or a second book. I know he's not gonna die, but also I'm like, oh shit, is he gonna die? And the twist of like it's so quickly how it happens, and the sound was almost like drowned out, so you don't exactly hear what happens first.
Yeah,
he stabbed him out of, he took that knife out of his stomach and stabbed him. I was like, oh man, like somehow, even though I know what's gonna happen in some sense, they still had me on the edge of my seat, like not being able to breathe. How is this gonna happen? How is this gonna go down? Because Matt, it's one of those things that you mentioned it earlier. It's like, is he going to die in order for like the good thing, like to be the good guy, to be the hero? Like, yeah. oh no, you fought well, Atreides, yeah. And Butler goes down. I love that twist.
they even have the line to set it up like a prophet who dies even stronger. You know what I mean? And that's when I was like, oh my God, this is going to like Austin Butler's going to be the guy. You know what I mean? Like, right. No. And it's a callback to the Gurney fight from Dune 1. You know, I got you, but you would have joined me in death kind of thing.
Right.
All very good. All very, very good.
Yeah.
David?
I had a couple more. The Emperor's ship, which is the way it looked. So that was really cool.
On fire.
Yeah.
The reflection, you can see the reflection of Arrakis on that silver ship. It's so good.
Yeah, it's so sci-fi and it looks really cool. And like the way and the way it plants and like plants its army and like it's like just like it's like immediately almost like setting up base, really cool. We've mentioned so many on here, but we've only kind of touched on it. Just the Anya Taylor-Joy moment. I remember it getting spoiled that she's in the movie and I was like, oh shit. I was like, oh right. Like I forgot she was in this. I forgot like
there's probably a variety article or something.
She went to a red carpet. Mm. So it was just kind of
I've already heard about it.
They did.
Oh, they did.
They did. Last one I had, and it was related to I think this is the last one I had. We don't have to talk about it more. None of us are gonna be able to say it is cool. The silence moment. Holy shit. Like that is just an all time. That is all time. That is going to be something where years and years down the line, that is just some like just that one clip you're going to see and be like, oh my gosh, remember that. Remember how cool that was. May thy knife chip and shatter that back and forth.
May my knife chip and shatter.
Yeah. Like Austin Butler saying it back. It's so great. Austin Butler is amazing.
So good, dude. What a dick.
Like he is. He gives this movie so much spark.
Yeah.
Like it really is. It's a spark because while every other character feels like they're kind of in place A, so they're going to do thing B and they're a part of group C and they're going to do this and that. Then there's just Austin Butler, you know,
vegetable soup.
Like when he smiles at the silence thing, like all these, he's such like a wild card, X Factor, Joker like character. It was just so necessary and needed, and he's just a lightning strike the entire movie.
Yeah. The conversation the Reverend Mother and Jessica have afterwards, like the Reverend Mother's like, you know what's about to happen, right? And she's like, oh, I know exactly what's about to happen.
Yeah.
And she's like, you know it's gonna be like the end of us, right? And she's like, I know. And that's exactly what I was going for. Like Jessica Ferguson taking on the role of like, oh no, I don't think I know. I planned. I like giving it right back to her finally after she was such a dick the last movie. So good.
Yeah.
Also when Jessica, when he starts rolling up and starts yelling at everybody, Jessica Ferguson, slow down.
Yeah. Slow down.
Oh
God.
What a moment. I love how after we see Anya Taylor-Joy, we now hear the baby and it's her voice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's yeah. Great. Mm-hmm. It's Diddy doing Diddy shit.
By the way, sorry. Mm. Was it because she took the water of life that then that was the connection, like how she could communicate, how the vision happened?
Yeah.
And in the book, at some point in the book, there's like a 2-year time jump. And so the sister's already born and she's like a 2-year-old, 1-year-old, and she's got a mind of an adult. And so I think that's why the change was made, because in the original movie they have like a 4 or 5 year old speaking and like with an adult voice. It's very odd. David, so good change.
In the book and in the 80s movie, there's a little girl who kills Baron Harkonnen.
Really?
It's a little murder baby. Yeah.
That is so fascinating.
Chucky, also inspired by Dune.
That is a very, that is a very good change.
No, and I say this kind of as a joke, but also like it's a Stewie situation where like a baby's going to be 100%. Born as a full blown adult, therefore going to do full blown adult things without the knowledge of a person. You know what I mean?
Right.
Sand
more time. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm so sorry I interrupted. But we see the ocean of Arrakis with Anya Taylor-Joy. Epic.
Yes.
Go ahead. So Jack.
I was just gonna say the stomping for the Emperor to kneel down, like no words needed, just the stomp of Timothy forcing him to get down on his knees. I was like,
awesome.
That was another moment where I was like, Jesus fucking Christ. And plus that's exactly, and that's why you get Christopher Walken, because that's also a moment of like that's Christopher Walken. You don't do that to Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
Last thing, Chani's blue scarf. It makes no sense. It shouldn't be there. She's worse off for it. Very happy it was there.
I like that.
It's the Power Rangers thing I love. You know what I mean? Like, that's ours. That's our girl. We're going to follow our desert stream or whatever the fuck it is.
We made this the last one, but we already talked about it. It was just the final sequence with Zendaya, the end of the movie. Like, that is such a top play. It is just, I couldn't believe it. And I'm like, and then I'm like, it's going to end here. Like, the credits are about to roll. And then it does. And I'm like, no.
Like, I'm leaning forward like so hard in that moment, like hoping that this is where you want a post credit scene, right? But you're not going to get it because this is a sad movie.
Zendaya does the crying face, holding back tears, trying to be brave look better than anyone out there. It is so good. Who's your other option?
Tom Holland.
Different looks.
No Way Home is a really good movie.
Yeah, him staying on the billboard looking at JJ on the thing. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. You're right. Oh, man, that's a good part, too. Let's talk about that, man.
Yeah. All right, so next week we're going to re-review No Way Home. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been Dune Part 2. What an incredible movie. We're so happy. Made $82.5 million domestically open weekend. Shout out, David. I know that's within your five, right? You were 78?
It was not. It was 75, so I'm just outside. Yeah, I went too low. Yeah, but you're overhit. Now I'm happy about it. Hit. Yeah.
Right. The exact same opening weekend as Oppenheimer.
Yeah, it like barely edges it out by like half a million. It's awesome. It was crazy because yesterday I'm like, oh, it's gonna be. It was just under Oppenheimer, like I said, and then today it's like update. Yeah, it's the same as Oppenheimer.
Movies are so back, dude.
48%. 48% worldwide of the gross premium theaters. 48.
Well, I mean, it's such a default. See this on the biggest screen you possibly can. Like,
yeah.
Like, how many of us didn't want to tweet that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Every social reaction.
No. It's like Jack not wanting to pick Timothy Chalamet as his biggest winner because everybody else is going to.
Right. But it's true. It's true.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. It's incredible. We'll talk more about that next week for sure. And we're gonna react to Oscars next week.
Oh,
which
big
is
one.
Gonna be great.
Yeah,
this movie not releasing in November is fucking wild.
Yeah,
we'll talk about that next week a lot.
We got, and by the way, we got us three, everyone listening. We have to make sure next year, this time, Dune is up for a lot of awards. We got to make sure when it is award season this upcoming year, when it is October, November, December. Hey guys, remember Dune. Let's all remember Dune. Yeah. Let's all watch Dune on net or on Max. Let's all buy the Blu-rays. Let's all remember Dune because this is an early, you know, best picture possible nominee. One of the best movies of the, it's going to be a while until this is topped. I think on like my personal rankings of like the best movie of 2024, if it is this entire year. And we just gotta remind people because this is early in the year at the end of the year,
years.
How great Dune is. Yeah.
If Everything Everywhere All at Once can do it,
right,
so can Dune Part 2.
It's back to back years of like 9 month runs.
Yeah.
That. Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah. And then Oppenheimer ended up being
another movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Good for them.
Yeah. Good for them. That's incredible. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been Dune 2. Jack, thank you so much for joining us. We love you. We're happy you were here. You've seen this movie too many times already. It's good stuff. Really happy that we're here. Next week, Dune box office reaction, Oscar predictions. No, Oscar reactions, I should say.
Yeah.
And then that'll be it. And everything else you need to know
everything
about
you
the
know.
Universe you love right here on the Direct Podcast. For David, Jack, I'm Matt. Until then, we'll see you next time.